everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 37. And this evening, we're talking about the week of March the 29th through April the 4th, 1989. Full calendar year from last week's show, as we're on Super Sunday 2 this week. And with it being WrestleMania week end, and when we're recording this show, you know, there's a lot of people out and about and doing different things. So myself and my co-host, Mr. David Binks and Span, decided to go solo again this week. And Binks, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I don't think that's what solo means, though.
Solo. We're solo as a we're two people combined as one. So we're solo.
Two of hearts, two hearts who beat is one.
That's right. Yes. So we are guestless this week. So may not be as long of a show, and that's a good thing probably for some of us.
Well,
so,
I mean, we've been trying to figure out how to fit this between everything.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, as we're recording this, Shimmer is about to start. One of many, many shows this week.
Oh my God, yes, yes. Look, yeah, just imagine they had this stuff in 1989. The random indie promotions running around Atlantic City, New Jersey. Crockett running, NWA running somewhere like Newark or something against or maybe the Meadowlands. They would have run the Meadowlands probably against Mania in Atlantic City. But anyway, yeah, it's crazy weekend. All right. So we start off here, Super Sunday 2, with the National Wrestling Alliance. And the biggest story of the week here.
Well, we should probably preface just explaining the Super Sunday thing briefly again.
Sure. Super Sunday 1, of course, was the year before. Clash Champions 1 versus WrestleMania 4. So Crockett going with a free show against WrestleMania.
Which we covered last week.
Which we covered last week. And now this week is part two with not Jim Crockett no longer involved. It's NWA. And they're running their clash at the Superdome against Mania 5. And you'll see some similarities here between the two shows.
Although there's also a reason they're running at the Superdome, which was that – I remember we talked about this last week. The – cable companies did not like that Vince was trying to go around the distributors to get a bigger cut of the pay-per-view money. Mm-hmm. So they had this plan where they went to Ted Turner to get a WCW show on pay-per-view that they put all their weight behind and not carry WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I don't know if it was their idea, and they were like, book it at the Superdome. Or if it was a WCW Jim Herd idea, but they booked the Superdome and WrestleMania ended up going on as normal, and should we save the details of what happened as far as the Superdome itself for a little bit later?
Yeah, we'll get there.
We'll get there, but not before too long.
Because the biggest story of the week is involving that in a way which changed the whole direction of the show, as George Scott was fired as the booker for the NWA on March 28th. So yeah, it's a day before a week, but it's, you know, a key integral part of the week. And he was fired for a variety of reasons, but the main one was that his bosses perceived that the NWA was going nowhere, the TV was awful, and the Clash of the Champions show that was coming 5 days later going head-to-head WrestleMania was the worst hype major card in wrestling history. When he was fired, there were only a few hundred tickets sold at the Superdome in New Orleans. And that building is gigantic. A few hundred. The only advantage of Scott's poor job of publicizing the show was they were able to switch the lineup around since nobody knew any of the matches except Ric Flair versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Now, Matt Watch spoke with Jim Herd and Jack Petrick, and they told them that they were highly upset with the March 25th episode of World Championship Wrestling, which only mentioned the upcoming Clash show with 2 15-second promos and a token plug of the upcoming Friday's countdown to the Clash. Jack Petrick said that his office told no one to dilute the Clash promotion, and it was Scott himself that was telling the announcers and wrestlers to soft-pedal the plugs because a hard sell would hurt the other house shows on the circuit. The higher-ups were also upset that Scott was going against their edict of hiring young, exciting, and fresh talent, then bringing in Iron Sheik and Butch Reed, as well as pushing the Junkyard Dog, as well as going after other WWE free treads after WrestleMania. There were rumors going around that Scott was actually on the WWE payroll to sabotage the promotion, and he actually did call them looking for work after he was fired. Scott was being replaced by a committee of, and it's that great word, committee, Jim Barnett, Ric Flair, Eddie Gilbert, Jim Herd, Jim Ross, and Kevin Sullivan, with Gilbert, Ross, and Sullivan being the main influences. Talk around the wrestling world was that Bill Watts was going to be contacted very soon as well as others, but he was rumored to be the key candidate.
There we go again.
Watts did meet with Herd on April 1st in New Orleans, but the meeting was said to have been brief, and there was no chance Watts would be coming in at the present time. Ole Anderson was in the offices on March 30th, openly campaigning for the booking job. The higher-ups are said not to want an active wrestler as the head booker at the moment.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, there was also something we should mention that I don't believe was part of the Matt Watch reporting at the time.
At the time, no.
But came out later in the Matt Watch Farewell, the 1991 annual, which was that Jim Herd had no idea what happened with the Saturday Night Show 8 days before the Clash until Steve Beverly called him, asking him to make sure that this was not something he had ordered, that they would during the body of the show there would be no mentions of the Clash, and that the only mentions of it were the two 15-second pre-tape videos, just regular promo ads, and the plug at the end for everyone to watch Countdown to Clash. And Herd was like, no. And that kind of led to George Scott being fired, because he thought this would hurt the house shows. And
that's George Scott coming from an antiquated thought of how wrestling was supposed to be done, which when he was in charge of Jim Crockett Promotions in the 70s and early 80s, I mean, that's how you did business. The house shows were the big deal, but now we're in an era where wrestling is becoming a television product, and you got a big show coming up head to head against your competition, and you're not promoting it. Right. I mean, if I was her and Petrick, I'd be, shitting bricks. I mean, it's asinine to think about the incompetence of George Scott. So,
I mean, maybe, do you think he sabotaged the, or?
I don't think there was any truth to that. I don't think.
Well, you've heard Cornette's theory, right?
Yes.
That he had dementia, or was in the early stages of some kind of dementia.
I can believe something like that. I can believe that he had, maybe it's something to that. But I do not believe that he was. That's like the Vince Russo thing, where Russo was sent in by McMahon to kill WCW. Now we're throwing all kinds of conspiracy theories out there, so I don't believe it. But speaking of Jim Cornette, and that's a good segue, this posed an interesting issue with the Midnight Express, who put in their notice a couple of weeks ago, mainly because of Scott and the new committee want them to stick around as well as push them, but they are still leaving with a door open to return. Now, Midnight Express had basically been relegated to spot shows in the Carolinas and, rarely in a, top match on any show, and not a lot of television exposure. Jim Cornette was phased down heavily on television. It was a tough time, and they were making money. I mean, what was it, $225,000 a year, I think, was what the Midnights were making, Bix, or was the Cornette? I still remember $225,000.
They were still on the contract amount that they negotiated with Crockett, right?
Yes. And they were wanting to cut payroll, of course, but, the Midnights and Cornette's a valuable commodity. And just the way Scott was treating them was crazy. And you can see why that they would want out, because they just got tired of it. And they weren't going to WWF. That was never even talked about, of course. They were just going to go work some independents. I know they did some work at Continental.
I think it ended up being, I don't have the Midnight Express scrapbook in front of me right now, but I believe it was 2 to 3 shows, like one or two shows in Continental as a favor to Bill Dundee, because he was booking.
Mm-hmm.
And one show in Was it Virginia for Dominic DiNucci?
Yeah, but did they work for Coraluzzo? Because that was being talked about.
No. So I think it was West Virginia for Dominic DiNucci, where they did Midnight Express, which was Bad Company, managed by Mark Curtis.
Which sounds awesome. And, so they rested. I mean, it was time for rest. And there's a promo which didn't air in our week. It aired on the television after, the week after this, where Cornette basically shoots on the air, you know, about the situation in a way, saying, you know, talk about their backstage politics and stuff like that. So, yeah, he got it on the air. But
and then when they came back, because it was really – I mean, they had given their notice. They decided not to leave, but they said they needed a refresh. And I forget what the line Cornette says in the promo where he's basically shooting on it. It's something like, you know, we're going to come back when – it was some line about the promotion. And then they came back as the mystery team in the tag title tournament.
Yes. Now, to the
class. A huge pop.
Yeah, very, very huge pop.
Although I don't think they didn't really acknowledge on TV that the Midnights had been gone, right? I mean,
they weren't making a huge deal out of it.
So I mean, and then when they came back, it was sort of like we haven't seen them in a few weeks, but it wasn't made as big a deal as the fans at Center Stage thought it was.
Yes. Now, of course, with all this stuff going on, the Clash is in a complete uproar. And they were booking that show on the fly. And supposedly they had a hot and heavy booking meeting until the wee hours of the morning, the night before the show. Ric Flair had the responsibility to help coordinate the show itself and then had to go out and do a classic match. Throw away the economics. As a wrestling show, this was the best show of the day, according to Dave Meltzer. The difference wasn't as great as last year, but it's still a sizable difference and really beyond any comparison. Several matches had to be short because they fell so far behind in time, and the final two matches wouldn't air until the TBS show that the next Saturday afternoon, which wasn't the original plan. So, that was a problem.
They played it off well on TV. On TV, they ended up having Ross cover for it on commentary, like those are your standby matches.
Yes. And the early matches went way too long, and then they started rushing matches before the Flair Steamboat match. So the time, whoever timed the show was just, oh.
Well, I don't think there was anyone timing the show, because wasn't it the same thing that no one replaced JJ after he left? I think it was this and Chi-Town Rumble had the same problem.
Yes, until they finally got somebody that timed it. But,
imagine.
This is a major league promotion. Oh, God. Anyway, the NWA took a major step forward, though, and they were more glitzy ring introductions, which purists may not like these type of intros, but that is one of the things that which makes casuals think that WWF is better. Ironically, the NWA had better entrances than WWF had at WrestleMania. Technically,
by a long shot.
Yeah. Technically, Dave's found this show a great improvement as well. No problem with the mics being turned off during hot spots and matches. The camera did miss a key sequence in the Eddie Gilbert match and didn't get the whole story to finish the Midnight Express match, but overall the work was good. The announcement was excellent. Jim Ross was great as usual. Now, although maybe not in the level of Chi-Town Rumble, but the matches weren't as good as in Chicago. Michael Hayes is a color man, has already made those who made this decision look like wise men. Hayes was really hot this show and was a shade better than Jesse Ventura. You know, the crowd was small. Once they got warmed up during the first second match, they reacted well, although they never went crazy either. Having come into the entrances, I must mention that one entrance, that of the Junkyard Doll, fell flat. It was a nice idea, but it didn't work.
Terry Funk, you should probably explain what the entrance was.
Yeah, we'll talk about that during the match. Yes. Terry Funk called the main event with Jim Ross, and they were able to get across that the match was a classic. Overall, even with the flaws, I don't see how anyone can complain too much about a car with that main event, especially when it's for free. All right, now let's talk about the show.
Well, we should mention the business that this show did.
Yes,
we should get that out of the way because it's like you can't watch the show without thinking about how weird it looks. So,
yeah, 5,300 fans, 1,300 paid.
$15,000 house.
$15,000
house at the Superdome.
Yes. Yes. Oof. All right. First match was Samoan SWAT team over the Midnight Express at 20:33. Samu pinned Eaton after Fatu hit Eaton over the back of the head with the foam.
See what he was saying about long matches at the beginning.
Yeah, Eaton hit the rocket launcher. After he hit the rocket launcher, made a cover. 3 stars, according to Dave. And this is the Great Muda, or as Dave calls him, the fucking Great Muda. Pinned Steve Casey with a moonsault in 8-11 in a 3.5-star match. All right.
This is Stephen Dane, by the way. That's Steve Casey.
Okay. Now, here's Dave on Muda. The opening interest was great. Muda blew the green mist in Casey's eyes at the start and then proceeded to do every great move in the back, including a backward drop kick, a handspring elbow drive outside the ring, no less. And with the right way of using Muda, he can actually be the Jimmy Snuka of the 1990s, as he's actually a ton better working than Snuka was in his prime. A few too many nerve holes in the middle, and they didn't need to go this long, especially in hindsight when they had the canned matches with Sting and Luger because they ran over in time. But still, for an incredible one-man show, 3.5 stars. Yeah, I mean, Muda was – this is the early part of his run here. And he was just insane.
Yes.
I mean, it was nothing like anybody had really seen before, especially in that promotion.
Now, well, certainly.
Yes. All right. Now, Junkyard Dog and Butch Reed and Bix, I will let you talk about the Junkyard Dog's intro.
Excuse me. He had a live band. What would you call it? It was like
it's one of those New Orleans-style jazz bands.
Yeah, New Orleans, like, Jet Parade jazz band type of thing.
Yeah.
And wasn't there originally a plan on this? Wait, is Abdullah on this show, or was he scheduled to be on the show at some point?
The whole original show was thrown away when Scott was fired.
But do you have the originally announced lineup?
I do not have the originally announced lineup. And they say the only match that announced was really Flair and Steamboat. So I'm pretty sure Abdullah was probably supposed to be on here somewhere.
Because I remember in Gary Hart's book, like, he said something like they had planned for Abdullah to come out to, like, New Orleans gospel funeral music.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But I guess this replaced that.
Yes.
And this, didn't they play when
the Saints come marching in? Isn't that when they play?
I think so. And this has probably the non-in-ring highlight of the show, or one of them. Excuse me. I'm just, I keep almost burping and then being horrified that they'll do it into the microphone. I don't have it queued up because I had trouble finding it, but Hayes on commentary is talking about how he had feuded with the Junkyard Dog. In fact, he says something to the effect of, "We set the attendance record in this building." Until tonight, of course.
Yeah, and
I'm guessing people who are listening to this have seen this show.
If you haven't, it's on WWE Network, so go check it out.
Although a few of the matches are missing.
Yeah.
I believe the U.S. tag titles, I think it's everything from what we have coming up here. I think it might be everything. It might be the 3 matches before the main event. I'm not sure, though. I'd have to check.
Dave on JY on this spectacle. JYD missed something like 8 shows in a row and said they'd been fired, but returned on Monday in Chattanooga, and they wanted him on this show because they thought he'd draw fans in New Orleans.
Well,
if this was 1983, he would have, but this isn't the same wrestler, nor is Reed. JYD's ring entrance was a time-consuming, complete and total disaster. The match was horrible, saved only by Michael Hayes' smart-ass commentary. Lots of stalling, and both guys still blew it within 4 minutes. This belonged at WrestleMania 4. -1 star. Wow. Bob Orton Jr. pinned Captain Redneck Dick Murdoch 9:48 when Harp swept Murdoch's legs as he attempted the brainbuster, then held the foot down during the cover. During the match, Pat O'Connor, Luthez, Sam Mushnick, Buddy Rose, Gene Kaniski, and Dory Funk Jr. were shown in the crowd. 1.5 star.
Okay, so I have Jason Campbell's site pulled up because I wanted to have the, you know, all the business info.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, he has that match listed as going 33 seconds.
Yeah, I know. I saw that in the pass line. That's not right. And apparently, what Dave said, they were supposed to go 15 to 16 minutes. So they started out slow. The first 7 minutes were horrible. Then all of a sudden they got the signal to go home early and had to go right to the finish. NWA, everybody. All right. NWA World Tag Title Match. Might return to Dr. Death Steve Williams, the Varsity Club, defeated the Road Warriors to win the titles in 11:37. When Williams pinned Road Warrior Hawk with a roll-up and a fast count from referee Teddy Long, moments after Long refused to count Hawk's cover in Rotunda following the Doomsday Device, because the champions manhandled him shortly before. After the bout, Jim Ross conducted an interview with the Road Warriors about the controversial decision, which I don't think we have, but yeah.
The all-time great fast count.
And check this out, though, for the record. This was the first pinfall loss of the Road Warriors in over 3 years since they lost to the AWA World Tag Titles to Jimmy Garvin and Steve Regal. Did you know that, Bix?
I think I did. Neither is exactly clean.
No.
Although you've seen how the AWA tried to play off that one, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where it's Michael Hayes. What is it? Is it? I think it's all the Freebirds come out, right?
Yes.
And there's a brawl, and the camera focuses outside the ring. Meanwhile, Hayes attacks, I think, Animal off camera. And they just, whoever it is, Rod Tronkard, is just like, oh, well, something happened. Road Warriors lost, everybody.
Amazing. Speaking of amazing, Ranger Ross beat the Iron Sheik by DQ in 156. In which Dave said, TGFSM, thank God for short matches. Ross came down from the ceiling as his entrance repelled. Sheik then sold Ross's early martial arts moves. He quickly did the combat kick and Rip Morgan, the Sheik's flag holder, interfered for the DQ. JYD did the run-in or walk-in for the save. Negative half star.
Why are you going to book that match? Why would anyone book that?
Who knows? I mean, they were just trying to they were trying to get this thing over with, I think. Yeah, let's just get it done.
And why was Rip Morgan the Iron Sheik's flag bearer anyway? Because he had experience as a flag bearer?
Yes, he was a adept bearer of flags from working with the sheep herders. And he was foreign. Bix. You know, you gotta keep foreigners together.
New Zealand and Iran?
Well, they were heels. There's no need to explain this. It's wrestling logic. As Conan once said, does this make logic?
If you say so.
Speaking of illogical, Eddie Gilbert and Rick Steiner retained the United States tag titles, beating Danny Spivey and Kevin Sullivan in 3 minutes and 51 seconds.
You forgot to properly identify them as being part of the Varsity Club.
Part of the Varsity Club, the other half of the Varsity Club. When Gilbert pinned Sullivan after hitting him with Missy Hyatt's Louis Vuitton purse, not Gucci purse. This match was so short since they were running so late on time by this point. Dave Sage should point out that this was a rematch of a match held on television the day before, which we'll talk about, when Sullivan and Spivey won a non-title match pretty much clean with Sullivan pinning Gilbert. Ironically, in a rare hype mistake by Ross, they never acknowledged on television about the titles on the Saturday show and didn't even make a single comment about it being a title or non-title match. And when Gilbert and Steiner lost, they didn't mention the match here or how the non-title makes the Varsity Club top contenders or anything. 1 3/4 stars. This promotion, folks.
Yeah. One of my favorite things in that Matt Watch annual thing where he goes over all the stories of the Matt Watch year, like the big stories, and he talks about George Scott and how, I think it was George Scott's first TV taping, Dan Spivey joins the Varsity Club with no notice, like no promo or anything.
Yeah.
And I think it was somewhere in Georgia, and like just no one there had any clue that he had ever played football for Vince Dooley.
Because it was so far, it was 15 years before.
I know.
Because you look at Dan Spivey and you thought he was a younger guy, but no, he would play college football in the early to mid 70s.
He didn't start wrestling till 84, and he was
even out of college 10 years.
He was almost 30, right?
Shit, he was over 30.
Oh, he was over 30 when he started wrestling.
Yes. Between the Sheik's favorite Dan Spivey. It's been too long since we've talked about him on the show.
Male model Dan Spivey.
Yes.
Fake Barry Windham Dan Spivey.
WWE rehab guru Dan Spivey.
Liaison,
excuse me. And then we come to the match that saved the day. Two out of three falls. NWA World Heavyweight title. Ricky Steamboat beat Ric Flair. 55 minutes and 32 seconds. And, you know, this is the second match of the Holy Trinity of the 89 series. And, Bix, I don't know about you, but this is my favorite of the three.
I go back and forth between this and Chicago because they're two very different matches.
That's the one thing we can say about all three of them. They were all different in a way. Although, but this one was the crown jewel, of, you know, to me.
The more time goes on, the more I really don't get why people ever thought WrestleWar was the best.
Like, well, because of the angle after the match.
Well, the angle, and it had the build-up that it's the last match, and then people knew Flair was going to turn, and it's the most self-consciously epic of the matches, but I don't think it's really close to as good as the previous two.
No. And Dave's theory on your theory about the Chicago is that the only comparisons you can make to this match, Chicago match, are that Chicago had more magic because of the drama and the title change. It also had a lot more heat. And it's easy to get heat in a nearly packed building rather than an almost empty building. Both guys worked much harder here than in Chicago and did a lot more actual stuff, but they had so much time to do it. So there's your difference. Now, the key thing in this match was the second fall finish. All right, Steamboat won it in 15:26 by submission, in which Dave said, when was the last time you heard a major star submitting with a double chicken wing? And then you had your third fall where Steamboat took the final fall in 20:31 when he went for the chicken wing again, but his legs gave out. Still managed to turn into a double cradle type pin. Ref counted three, and we weren't sure who had won or if it had been a double pin draw, but they ruled Steamboat the winner. The main camera on replay didn't show conclusively that Flair's foot was on the ropes, but a second camera angle showed during Steamboat's post-match interview clearly showed Flair's foot on the ropes for the, quote, controversy, unquote, at least to another match. For those who like the actual art of wrestling with lots of subtleties, selling moves, and wrestling-based moves, this was the best match in this country in a few years. By today's standards, some may have found this match a little slow-paced because they had been pacing themselves for such a long match. Even though Flair has proven himself in these matches of late, that he's still beyond compare with any modern-day wrestler, the combination of having these nightly great efforts plus the addition of booking may eventually take its toll. At least it would with a normal human, wouldn't it? Still, in every standard comparison, this was a lot better than last year's Flair and Sting match of the year. And also, the surprise pinfall was a nice touch because I'm sure everyone in America knew they were going the full 60 to a draw. 5 stars.
And actually, I believe the original plan was that they were going to go the full 60 to a draw.
Yep.
Now, would you agree that this is probably, of what we have on tape, of course, the best of the long world title matches that we've seen? Your hour, close to an hour long world title matches.
If it's not the best, it's right there.
It's right there. Yeah. I mean, what would be in the conversation? Like, I've never seen the Miami Funk Briscoe.
Yeah.
That reminds me. Someone asked a while back, like, if I knew, so I think I know someone that might have a copy because Wrestling Classics used to sell it, but you never see it anywhere anymore.
No. Flair Steamboat from 84 is, I mean, right there with it.
The Charlotte match?
The March match.
From Boogie Jam. I still have not seen that since that came out. You would say that's right there with it? The babyface match?
Yes.
Okay.
God. I mean, I have to think about it, but if it's not the best, it is right there with it.
Inoki versus Dory Funk Jr. from 69 is one I like a lot. I don't think it's quite as good as this.
And it's different.
It's different.
It's 1969.
I think this is definitely the best of the long Flair matches we have.
Yes. And, if you haven't seen this match, I mean, you got to see this match. I mean, it's one of those matches that you must see as a wrestling fan. You just have to.
And they cut a good pace as far as with the mat work and stuff. I mean, there's no laying around. They're always working.
Yeah, and they timed the falls right. I mean, you had a 19:35 first fall, a 15:26 second fall, and a 20:31 third fall. So really, the falls were almost equaled out.
Yep.
So you didn't have what you have in Lucha where you have, you know, a quick first, second fall, then a long-ass third fall. So they got that one right on a show where a lot of things was wrong. So, and the Flair stuff with the booking, yeah, that would be an interesting story for the rest of the year, no doubt. But it gets better. If you remember last week, we talked about WWF buying time during the Clash 1 to get their 900 ad on the air. They bought six spots. They got five of them were Knicks, and one got through. Guess what happened this time? I don't know how they did it, Dave said, but just after the Flair Steamboat match concluded, WWF had a TV ad for their 900 number telling people to call in and hear the live WrestleMania reports. They got this commercial through last year, and there was hell to pay. How they ever got it through this year is beyond me. Yes.
And this time they own the promotion.
Yes.
That this is going up, that's promoting the Clash. This is not just a company that they work with. They own this promotion. And
to finish off the Clash real quick before we get in more of that goodness, Sting pinned Rip Morgan in a TV title match. This is after the show was over. And then Luger pinned Jack Victor with a torture rack. U.S. title match, I guess. So there's your two matches that were quote-unquote standby matches.
But weren't. They were advertised regular matches.
Yes.
And the show went.
Just clusterfuck galore here. All right. A further embarrassment for the NWA was that Turner's own CNN sent a film crew to Atlantic City giving a ton of coverage of Mania, but never once mentioned the Clash. USA Today on March 31st did a big story on Mania as well, but covered a Clash also. Hulk Hogan in the article called the NWA, quote, a small outlaw group, unquote, which was spawned from Ricky Steamboat saying the WWF didn't have as much wrestling as the NWA. The story talked about how WWF had 135 closed circuit locations, but the ad listed 64 locations. It gets better. Bryant Gumbel was on the Today Show on that Monday after and said that he watched both the Clash show and WrestleMania 5 and said that he thought the Clash was much better before basically apologizing because of the WWF's relationship with NBC.
By the way,
this is awesome, Bix. I mean, just the, you know, your television partners, you know, the promotion are getting screwed by them. Oh, wrestling.
And I was going to say, we did forget something minor, although we should mention it, with all the, you know, laser light shows they had for the entrances of the Clash.
Yes.
Ric Flair's R-I-C-K Flair.
R-I-C-K Flair. Yep, they misspelled his name. Which wasn't the first time that happened, because if you remember when the big gold belt was created, the first nameplate was R-I-C-K Flair. This belt was made by Jim Crockett Promotions. And
speaking of which, remember when Jim Crockett threatened to sue the WWF saying he had the trademark for Ric Flair and they changed his name to R-I-C-K Flair for like 3 weeks?
Yes. God.
That's the best story no one ever talks about.
Yeah. And the thing about, I wish to God somebody has this Bryant Gumbel footage, because I would love to see Bryant Gumbel talk about how great the Ric Flair Ricky Steamboat match was, which is what he did on the air on the Today Show in 1989.
And then have to apologize.
And then have to apologize. And real quick, to close out the Clash discussion, and we're going to revert back to the television before the Clash after this. Terry Funk told friends after the Clash he was tired of listening to all the former NWA champs groan about how bad the business had become during the show.
Well, business was bad, old men. Not necessarily the business.
Yeah, all those crotchety old men. Back in my day, we used to sell out all these buildings. It's funny. That stuff goes on today with some of the people from like the 80s and 90s. I love to see them talk about how it used to be. Well, yeah, I mean, we always, you know, pined upon, you know, when we were younger, but I mean, times change. It's just the way it is. That's what they always say about Terry Funk. Terry Funk was always a guy that always knew what was going on, had his finger on the pulse. He always changed with the times. He wasn't like some of his cohorts, and that's why Terry Funk's Terry Funk. So
that's why Jory Funk is not Terry Funk.
Yes. Now, let's talk about the television before the Clash. I mean, this is complete insanity. All right, they taped the first ever show at Center Stage Theater on March 30th, 1989. And this was the Countdown to Clash taping. And it was basically only supposed to be just this part, this show, because there wasn't going to be any wrestling matches. It's just going to be interviews and blah, blah, blah. And they had a video package of Ricky Steamboat training with the help of his wife, Bonnie. And then we had the Danger Zone with Road Warriors and Paul Ellering, with dangerously getting bullied around before the Varsity Club. Before they cut a promo on the Varsity Club. Ross introduced Harley Race and Lou Dez, who both commented on the Flair Steamboat match. The crowd was largely behind Flair during this segment. Then there was a music video featuring the Flair Steamboat rivalry since January. Was that the Final Countdown video or no?
Final Countdown was for WrestleWar.
That's right. I wonder what music played in this one. I don't remember this video. And then he had the Ross had Flair and Steamboat out together for a little point counterpoint type deal, where the fans cheered Flair loudly over Steamboat. And then they showed the pre-tape match for the Omni on March 12th between Steiner and Gilbert versus Doc and Rotunda. And they taped the match on this show to air on the World Championship Wrestling on the next day, on April the 1st, where Sting beat Mike Rotunda for the NWA World Television title as Steamboat and Luger came down the ringside to offset the appearance of the Varsity Club. Sting also won $10,000 because Rotunda put that on the line. Remember that gimmick? Where you put the TV title and $10,000 on the line. Tully Blanchard did that gimmick. Arn did that gimmick, I think, for a while as TV champion as well.
I remember Tully.
It was a heel gimmick to do. And the reason why they had to tape this match here was because the match that they had taped at Techwood Studios the previous day was so bad they had to do it again. And, of course, there were fans that would attempt that were at both shows. So
they had taped it at Techwood, too.
Yeah. They told the fans who had attended both shows that there were some controversy regarding that the other match, and the title was held up. Yeah. If you watch which is never been aired on 24/7 or WWE Network, but I have it on DVD. If you watch that April 1st episode of World Championship Wrestling, everything is from Techwood except that one match. I always thought it was odd.
What did they say?
They basically pitched it to being a clip, like it was from a regular arena in
Didn't
a way.
They show the whole match though.
Yeah, showed the whole match. They never acknowledged where it was from.
They just said earlier this week.
If I'm mistaken,
did they acknowledge that Sting had already won the title, or did they act like live? We're going to.
No, they said that Rotunda was the champion.
Okay.
So. Talking about that, March the 30th at Techwood Studio, the final taping from the studios.
Ever.
So the an end of an era.
And a much overdue end of an era at this point.
Yes, the studios were not what they once were.
And you could argue they outgrew it by 87.
I tell you, I've been watching Crockett Television from 86, and I'm now in the fall of 86 going to Starrcade, and it's got to the point where when they would show when they did a special show from the Bash, where they didn't tape in the studio because they redid the floors, that changed the game. It changed the game.
Yep.
Because you got to see the house show atmosphere or the regular TV taping atmosphere, and that was it. Studios, it just wasn't the same after that. Anyway, back to this. Great Muta, Gary Hart, and Hiro Matsuda were on the Danger Zone, in which Paulie Danielson said Muta reminded him a lot of the Great Kabuki, which Gary Hart said, well, he should. He's his son. Now, they didn't run with this long.
Although, when Kabuki and Muta had their match in New Japan years later, it included possibly the greatest line in the history of wrestling, where Kabuki grabs the mic and says, Muta, my son, I fucking kill you.
So basically, I mean, they, I guess gimmick wise, he was his son in a way.
Yes.
So Gary Hart wasn't telling the truth, but it's still fine. All right. Listen to these return matches on this. Shane Douglas pins the Raider in a return match for Shane Douglas after being gone for a while. Bob Orton Jr. pinned Dwayne Bruce with a superplex. And 5:04, Gary Hart appeared to congratulate Orton after the match. And it's Bob Orton's return match to the promotions. Well, to God, he never was in this era of TBS, but first match in the NWA since 1984. And, of course, Dwayne Bruce is Mix.
Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker, tag team partner of famed Muscle Bear, Dale Veazey, a.k.a. Lieutenant James Earl Wright.
Yes. And then we have Ron Simmons in a return match beating Bucky Siegler. Ron Simmons, you know, he was off and on there for a while with his promotion.
Where did he go between, what, did he leave after Clash 4?
Yeah.
Where was he?
I don't know if he was hurt or whatever, but he would just go. In this time period, he would just bounce around. Hmm. And then we had a handicap match where Muda beat the Cruel Connection.
How often did you even see both of the Cruel Connection in this era?
I know. And, of course, the graphic before the match had Muda as Muto, his real name.
I thought it was – didn't they do an appearance or two where it said Mota? Too.
Mota, yeah. And this was the first time that he sprayed the mist. Was in the air in this match. So, yes. NWA is starting. I mean, there's still some stuff to go through. But getting rid of George Scott was the first big step in what would end up being a great year for the promotion. Yeah. Now, with the booking change, the arrivals of Billy Jack Keynes and Buddy Landell are no longer happening, as they were supposed to start the TV tapings in Daytona Beach on April the 3rd. Brian Pillman, Tom Pritchard, Shane Douglas was already started. They're supposed to start on those tapings. So, with Pillman and Pritchard expected to be a tag team and will be introduced as such.
Well.
The Dr. Tom Pritchard 1989 stuff, I need to get Dr. Tom on a show to talk about this subject. Because
what? Yeah, I didn't realize he was supposed to come in or expected.
Yes, numerous times in this year. Like, at least three times he had start dates. And he never showed up.
Where was he, Birmingham?
Continental, yeah. Hmm. He was Continental Heavyweight Champion at this time. Hmm. And then the last time they did the deal where he lost to Dennis Condrey. This was, I think, in August. And we'll talk about that on Exile down the line, but that's when he was supposed to go again, and just never went.
Also, funny how the moment Eddie Gilbert becomes Booker, all of his friends start coming in.
More than just that.
Well, yes.
Doug Gilbert is also said to be coming in as himself to heighten tensions within the first family.
Which didn't exactly go that way.
Well, you could see where Eddie was going to go, though.
Well, they used him as a TV job guy, and I guess Doug was going to be the catalyst for Eddie turning heel.
Yes. Which was, you know, would have been awesome.
But how I want to get back to Doug even there.
Maybe 2 to 3 months at the most. I want to get to this Pillman Pritchard deal first. I mean, there was talk about how they didn't know they're gonna be babyface or heel, but how do you think a Brian Pillman Tom Pritchard tag team would have worked in 1989?
I think they would have been great together.
As faces or heels?
Hmm. Pillman hadn't worked heel yet though.
Not yet. No.
I think they could have done well as both.
Maybe come in as babyface and turn.
Yeah.
Down the line.
Yeah. And Pillman also, Eddie Gilbert was going to bring him into Continental, but then he had the split with David Woods.
Yeah. And imagine like Pillman and Pritchard against the SST.
When
the Midnights came back.
Steiners.
Yep. Doom. But then we got the Dynamic Dudes, though. Pillman and Pritchard in the Dynamic Dudes role, that would have been interesting, I guess you could say.
Oh, boy.
Tom Pritchard is a surfer?
By the way, belated Mazel Tov to Mr. John Laurinaitis.
Yes.
He got me.
Mazel Tov. That's it.
To Ms. Kathy Colace, the mother of the Bella twins. And
yes.
And, of course, the beloved J.J. Bella.
Yes, and think about this, folks. We're going to have a family whenever John Cena decides to get married to Nikki. We're going to have a family of John Laurinaitis, Road Warrior Animal, Daniel Bryan, and John Cena.
You forgot Mike Laurinaitis.
And Mark Laurinaitis.
Ryan Mark Laurinaitis, not Mike Laurinaitis.
And James Laurinaitis, who plays football for the New Orleans Saints. So, I mean, yeah, this is – that's a family right there. Now, back to more of this new talent initiative. They're really pushing for Owen Hart to come in soon as his contract with WWF is up. And they've even talked to his father, Stu. WWF, though, has offered a sweetened financial deal for him to stay through the European tour. And they want him to unmask to work as himself.
Well, wait, how long would his contract have been? Because he didn't start with WWF until the end of July in 88.
Well, the supposed contract was expiring at Mania. He was going to be one of those guys. As mentioned by George Scott, he was going to go for some of those veterans that was going to get cut. And they kept him through the European tour after Mania. And I don't think he stayed a really lot longer than that.
So I guess if we assume he was under contract by the beginning of July, then he was signed for 9 months?
He may have been on a I mean, who knows what kind of contracts they were working back then. They could have been working like 6 month deals and
Well, when did he finish up? Because when did he go back to New Japan and when did he go back to Stampede?
Let's see. We have Blue Blazer here working in May. Wow. I think we got Blue Blazer working until late summer.
Okay, so he was under a 1 year contract.
His last date was July. He started no showing. His last date was June 26th. Okay. And he was being associated by Sam Houston in July.
So he was probably under a 1 year deal.
Yes.
But I don't think he went back to New Japan until 90, did he?
I don't think he worked in New Japan in 89, no.
So I guess he was in Stampede and...
Yeah.
Was he working for Ottawans?
He may have been working in Europe, yeah. Now, and WCW, NWA talking to Stu, you know, that could have been them trying to, you know, maybe do like a little deal with Stampede.
Perhaps.
Because Stu had talent there. A big Larry Cameron and other people, so...
Conan
was there. Would have made sense. Yeah, U.S. Mail, Curtis Thompson, between she's favorite.
Archangel.
Yeah.
The I mean, Black so Arts. You.
Yeah. Muck Insane.
Who came in a couple months later.
Yeah. So they could have worked a little satellite deal. More comings and goings in WCW and NWA. Nick Patrick is also coming in to replace Teddy Long as a referee, which would be Nick's first job back as a referee in 4-5 years. It's 84.
Where had he been? When did he hurt his knee? Was it in Mid-South?
85. Or? 85 in Continental.
So he wasn't working as a referee?
No, 85 Mid-South. 85 Mid-South. Mid-South. Because he went Mid-South at the Continental. He was working for Deep South as an announcer.
And a manager, right?
And he did some managing. But yeah, he was the announcer for his dad. Okay. Him and Rock Hunter. With Joe Pedicino at times. And then just... those two later on after Pedicino split. But
odd group that is.
Yeah, Deep South was interesting.
Patrick, Rock Hunter, and Joe Pedicino.
Yeah, if you watch the Pro Wrestling This Week's that are on the YouTube, like the early ones when they were aligned with Deep South, you have that goodness there on as the announcers. So go check it out when you get a chance. All right. The recently deceased Mark Scarpa, who was working here as Vince Young, not the quarterback from University of Texas, was fired on March the 30th for refusing to do a job for Bob Orton Jr. on the WCW tapings.
Well, there you go. By the way, we didn't really give enough conversation because it then was followed up with the guys Gilbert was bringing in. Billy Jack Haynes and Buddy Landell.
Yeah, let's talk about that real quick. Yeah. That... All right, Buddy was... This is right before he goes to Memphis again.
So where was he working?
He was working independent gigs. Okay. I know he was doing like matches with Jimmy Valiant and the Carolinas and stuff like that.
Is it possible he worked for Nelson Royal a little bit?
He may have. I could see that. And Billy Jack Haynes... he would go back to Portland and do his retirement angle, which of course he didn't do, and that's led to a feud with Grappler and John Nord, another Between the Sheets favorite, and that's where he went after this. But yeah, Billy Jack Haynes and Buddy Landell in 1989 NWA Bix. I mean, with George Scott as the booker, though. What are you looking at here? I mean,
I'm not even, how did George Scott know who Buddy Landell was?
Because he was a guy from from 5 years earlier.
But where would he have used him?
He didn't.
He never used him. No, but I'm saying he would, I guess.
He never used Billy. Well, he was with Billy Jack and WF, I guess.
At least the first time, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Was he maybe booking, did Buddy Landell work for McGurk when George Scott was booking there?
No, but Buddy was a TV jobber for Crockett when after George left. So, I mean, he knew him, but still, that would have been interesting to say the least, if those two who showed up.
Especially if they became friends.
Oh, man.
Think about that first.
Women and children beware, that's for sure. Those Daytona Beach tapings were interesting. All right, we had Great Muda blowing out his knee, doing a moonsault. But he continued to work through it, which was the story of his life. This was the first time I think that was noted that he did that. And they said that the next night at the tapings in West Palm Beach, he was working slower paced. But then they said the night after that, Miami, he was going full balls to the wall. So, yes. Now,
feel free to tell us, by the way, if you prefer that or me going dun dun dun.
I like that better personally, by the way. And I think
going dun dun dun.
No, the music. And I think that needs to be our cue for whenever the name Dr. James Andrews gets mentioned as well. Yes.
Terry Taylor.
Ron and Don Harris. Oh, man. All right, anyway. Road Warrior Hawk and Dr. Death Steve Williams had a near-ugly confrontation in the locker room that night in Daytona Beach before being separated, with Dave saying that whoever separated them had a lot of guts. I'll say, that's a fight I wouldn't want to be in the middle of. And no. Can you imagine the amount of steroids and drugs that was in those two systems at this time period?
Oh, my God. Monkey hormones?
Oh, Lord. Yes. Oh, they had to be fighting about drugs, too. Like, probably Hawk accused Dr. Death of stealing his horse tranquilizer or something like that. I mean, it had to be over something like that.
Do you realize that this bag that you stole from has drawn more money than Sting?
Oh, wow.
Which exile is that?
I can't remember, but I love that line. Oh. Jim Barnett, my boy, has been traveling around to independent shows to check on all the young talent on the scene, so expect a lot of new names coming in soon. I like the way he looks in them tights, my boy.
Isn't this just a few scant months before Tom Zank comes in wearing white trunks?
Yes. Oh, Tom Zank. Oh, my boy. Tom Zank has one of the best Jim Barnett voices of anybody.
Yes.
God bless Tom Zank. But yeah, we all. I mean, yeah, Jim Barnett was a great talent scout, but he is Jim Barnett.
Well, I mean, look, they're not going to hire a woman in the office in those. I mean, some promotions would. This promotion probably wasn't going to yet. But if you want to relate to the female fans, maybe the next big thing is to have an old gay dude.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, TB.
He was the one that was encouraging WWE to use John Cena when they weren't doing anything with him.
Yes. Hey, Jim Barnett was a great mind for the business.
Oh, yeah.
Great mind for the business.
But apparently there were people in the office who weren't listening to him because one of the things he was saying was that he shouldn't be wearing jean shorts because it's covering up too much of his body.
Yes.
That's real, by the way. I'm not making that up. That's a, and, that they weren't listening to him because he was saying.
Yeah. Well, Jim's Jim, but again, a great mind for the business and one of all, you know, the all-time greats and what he did. So, but he was Jim Barnett. He liked what he liked. It's not a secret. Everybody knows it. So
anyway, they did.
Yeah. Now moving on. And this is a little foreshadowing. TBS is very close to okaying a weekly Friday night NWA show, which would be similar to the old Pro Wrestling This Week show.
Well, yes and no.
Well, Joe Pedicino was involved. But yes, of course, this is alluding to the Power Hour. And in fact, the next week after this is when they announced it, that they would be starting in June.
Although there was one element, I guess, that you could say sort of was like Pro Wrestling This Week, which was that
Drunk
Power Hour, what?
Drunk Gorenzoli?
Oh. Was it right when it started or later when Power Hour consisted of matches from different places in each episode?
As far as like different tapings?
I thought they would have from different tapings in the same episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that at the beginning though?
Oh yeah, for a while. And what was so cool about that show, and what made it feel like Pro Wrestling This Week in a way, was that Gordon would acknowledge the WWF and other groups on the show.
When he did on his Wrestling News Network set.
Yeah.
So was Wrestling News Network only on Power Hour?
Only on Power Hour.
Okay, that explains it then.
Yep, only on Power Hour. And in our final story of this section, and this is one that's hits all of Bix's favorite spots. Matt Walsh reported that
act like you're not a fan of all this.
I know. This is a lot of your key stuff here. Matt Walsh reported that what had been rumored to be a certain sale of FNN, the TBS, has died because the TBS board of directors, led by opposition from major stockholder Telecommunications Inc. and its chairman, John Malone, defeated the proposal of a 45% interest into FNN. The deal was regarded by Malone as too expensive, and he convinced enough directors to nix it. Turner is not said to be unhappy about the squashing, but still has his eye on FNN, and such a purchase would mean the end of the weekend score service. Which, of course, that we gave the history of that on last week's show, but Bix, what ended up happening with FNN?
CNBC bought them.
Yeah, they became CNBC.
Well, no, CNBC already, I think, I forget if it was CNBC already existed, then they bought Tempo.
Yep.
Because Tempo was actually on in a lot of places, so there goes a bunch of wrestling programming, and then a bunch more when they buy FNN.
And now let's go to the land of the rising sun and All Japan Pro Wrestling as they're kicking off their champion carnival tour on March 29th at Korakuen Hall. Sellout house to 2150. Stan Hansen retained both his PWF and United National Heavyweight titles, pinning Tenryu Genichiro in 2002. Hey, the more things change, the more they stay the same from last week, huh? Masafushi also kept his PWF Junior Heavyweight title, defeating Mitsuo Momota in 1557. Momota has become a cult hero in Japan lately, as he was polled to be the most popular guy among the fans who watched the television show, with Dave Meltzer comparing him to Mulky Mania.
Hey, you know what? Momota was really good.
He was good, but it was odd that he was the most popular guy on the whole show.
Sure.
Because he was rarely even on. But
yeah, I mean, he was never on TV.
And this is like the very end of their run in prime time.
When was the move? 90?
It was in 89. It was like weeks so after this. In fact, it may have been 2 weeks after this, something like that. And you guys, we got to talk about Mulky Mania. Tell everybody what Mulky Mania was.
I think this is something you have to share with the people.
Okay, I'll do it. Bill and Randy Mulky were jobbers on Crockett Television in the mid-80s. And I've been watching the birth of Mulky Mania lately. And Jim Cornette's the one that coined the term on television. And basically what Bill and Randy Mulky were, where they just got the holy hell beat out of them every week.
They took the most ridiculous bumps.
They took the most ridiculous bumps. their matches against the Midnights, against the Andersons, I just watched them get annihilated by Raging and Ravishing this week. They were awesome jobbers. Like Vernon Deaton, another guy like that. They just went out there and got killed. And they did their job. I mean, they were doing what they're supposed to do. They were enhancing the other talent. They had their role and they served it well. But they became cult heroes because how they looked like, you know, Bobo Hulk Hogan's out there, but much skinnier and very white.
That's what you think? I don't know if I'd say that.
Well, that's where, I mean, really think about it. Mulkey Mania. What's that?
They had long,
they had the long hair. Yeah, the longest hair, same type of cut in a way. Or they look like more like Tommy Rich's Down syndrome nephews. But, but still at Bobo Hogan's. And, yeah, that's how they got over. And eventually, they got a win on television over
the California Tag Team Champions, the Gladiators.
The California Tag Team Champions, the Gladiators. So, a great moment in time. But yeah, Monkey Mania.
And they got to headline a house show in their hometown of Anderson, South Carolina, getting a U.S. tag title shot, I believe it was, against the Midnights.
Mm-hmm. Cornette loved them to death. But
he did not love Anderson, South Carolina, though.
No, he didn't love Anderson, South Carolina, no. But, yeah, the Mulkey Mania. Man. But Momota, though, I mean, yeah, he was always popular, but he was really popular this time period.
And he was still good with Noah.
Yeah.
Always weird. I mean, I know he was small, but for a guy who was a pretty good worker and the son of the most biggest lionized, idolized star in the history of Japanese wrestling, it's a little weird that he wasn't a bigger star.
Yeah, and well, you know, a guy should have been much bigger than what he was, and, you know, he was awesome with his opponent, Masafuchi. I mean, Fuchi, even though he was, you know, he would get spots in main events and trios, tags, and stuff like that, the fact that he never got a bigger run is just amazing to me because the guy was so great.
And then when like he was going to get a bigger run, Tenryu coming in after the split made sure that didn't happen.
Yeah.
He got his one main event, though. Was that a Budokan or a Korakuen? Where was it?
That was a Budokan.
So he did get a Budokan main event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Boy, do you remember seeing the magazine photos of that match when that happened?
Oh, yeah. I saw all the live photos of that match when it happened. It was interesting.
I don't remember seeing any, I still don't think I've ever seen a wrestler's chest as red from chops as Fuji's from that match.
Yeah, he was like Samoa Joe last night on TakeOver. But yeah, there was, I mean, like red as far as color, not because he was bleeding, just red.
Well, he was sort of bleeding.
Kind of, sort of, yeah. You know, from the chops.
He wasn't like actually bleeding though, like in a Ron Garvin Ric Flair match.
No. No, that's for sure. All right, New Japan Pro Wrestling. Not a lot going on this week, but a jump. And what a big jump this turned out to be. As Minoru Suzuki has jumped to the UWF in the past week, as he has fallen in the footsteps of his contemporary, Masakatsu Funaki, who jumped a week and a half earlier. Now think about that, folks. New Japan lost Masakatsu Funaki and Minoru Suzuki in a 10-day time period. In 1989, when they're about ready to just break out. How different is New Japan with those guys, you know, coming up on that roster?
Now, I guess, now I'm trying to think back then, would both of them have been heavyweights?
Well, they were young lions, so they probably would have been back and forth. But Funaki probably would have definitely grown into the heavyweight first.
Well, you mean after, because of what happened after he met Scott Hall in Europe? Yes, he would have grown into being
Yes.
Because of the certain things he learned how to properly utilize after he met Scott Hall in Europe? Yes.
Yes.
Suzuki, I'm not sure. And the thing is, it's like, is there any videotape of them before they left New Japan? Like handheld or anything?
Yeah.
Oh, there is. Okay.
I'm pretty damn sure there is.
I don't know if I've ever seen any. The rep is that Minoru Suzuki was the best of his class. Which, what year did he graduate the dojo?
He was after the Musketeers group.
He was 80. Was he 85 or 86?
He would have been in that era. Yeah, 86 probably.
Because he was there with Benoit, right?
Max Payne.
Benoit, Max Payne, Bryan Adams. But who were the Japanese guys? Other Japanese guys in that class? When was Nagami?
I guess Kazuki Sasaki, but he really. I mean, he was a Choshu guy at first, All Japan guy, but
and then he regraduated.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Funaki's. Yeah, Funaki was all over some 88 stuff.
And he was over. He was over big at the house shows, especially for a guy who wasn't on TV.
Yeah, Funaki worked the top of the Super Juniors tournament in 88.
Oh, okay, that's right. But he was the like because he was the only young lion I think that didn't dress like a young lion, right?
No. Yeah.
Or was it? Or one of the only.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he won the very few, and Minoru Suzuki did not appear on television.
Okay, but Funaki, I mean, at the time, who were the other young lions that didn't do the black trunks, black boots? I mean, I know there was Yamada before him, but that was part of his appeal, wasn't it? That he was a great worker who was a young lion but didn't dress like the young lions, so he stood out.
Well, he was stood out anyway because he was so young.
Well, yeah. How old is he at this point?
We talked about that he was on past shows when he was coming up, that he was like 15 or 16, you know, in the dojo. He would have been 20. He just turned 20 when he quit.
Yep.
Just turned 20. It's a freak.
Apparently, like, amazing, amazing worker. We've only seen a little of him for that, but, and this is, he's still green, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he had done his learning excursion, but I think Funaki becomes a pretty big star. I mean, Suzuki, do you think Suzuki's a junior heavyweight?
Start at first, yes. Suzuki, though, needed that seasoning from UWF. Yeah. Funaki was already there. I think Suzuki had that seasoning from guys like Anjo and, you know, guys like that. So
yeah, it's so weird because you think of Suzuki now,
and then Fujiwara going to war with Fujiwara and all that.
Yeah. But you think of Suzuki now, it's like it's all dependent though on that he had been a guy that was in shoot style groups and then doing MMA and stuff. You know what I mean? Like Funaki relies on it because he's more broken down, and so does Suzuki to an extent, but Suzuki crafted a whole persona around. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to think, like, so used to them as shoots. I mean, both were such good workers and great athletes, though, that I think they would have been big stars. And Suzuki always had that expressive face, too.
Yeah, he always had the charisma.
Like, I think he would have been a fairly big star. It's just a question of how they slotted him.
Yeah, I mean, Suzuki probably would have been the original version of a guy like a Kanemoto or a Tani, the junior punk.
Yeah.
Against Liger, you know. That would have been a great rivalry.
Yeah, so
Liger,
maybe
Suzuki
he would have
tearing it up.
He would have been. Yeah, maybe he would have gotten the spot Hanaga ended up getting.
Yeah, probably.
At least time wise.
Mm hmm.
And speaking of the UWF.
Yeah, they have tragedy. As an 18-year-old student, Kazuro Horiguchi died on March 31st from brain hemorrhage that he suffered the day before during a training session at the UWF dojo. Horiguchi had just started 2 weeks earlier, and the promotion at a press conference the next day, putting everything on the open. The story was he was practicing taking bumps and hit his head too hard, causing the hemorrhage. The UWF has already scheduled a charity show, with all the proceeds going to benefit the family this summer.
I can think of one promotion that absolutely did not learn from this at all.
Oh, yeah. New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a sad deal. And there's no telling how many times this stuff probably happened in Japan that really nobody really know about.
Yeah. I mean,
as far as back in the day.
Yeah. And of course, this is, you know, what we just said was obviously assuming this is what actually happened. But the fact that they got out in front of it and that is kind of against the Japanese way of handling these things makes me think that they're probably were completely honest here.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and there was nothing that came out of it as far as any controversy, anything. You know, there was no lawsuits or nothing like that. So, obviously, everything seemed to be on the up and up.
I mean, it happens. It's not like it doesn't happen.
Yeah, and it sounds like, I mean, he just fell taking a bump, so it was just a freak accident.
Yeah.
I mean, what can you do?
Yeah. Who else was in their dojo at the time?
Ooh.
Because I'm trying to think, because guys like Anjo was actually a veteran. He just didn't really become a star until UWFI.
Miyato?
Probably. Would Kanehar and Kakihara have been in the second UWF? Would they have been trained in the second UWF?
And I'm looking to see who would have been there around this time period. We have Tatsuo Nakano.
I think Nakano debuted in the original UWF, though.
Yeah. Tamura.
Yeah. I'm not sure how I forgot him, but yeah, Tamura.
Tamura.
So all of the younger UWF guys, I would think, were in the dojo at the time.
Yeah.
The younger natives, that is.
Yeah. Suzuki and Funaki, of course. Funaki probably would have been there.
Didn't they start wrestling for UWF pretty quickly? I don't think they stayed.
Yeah. Yeah,
Funaki. Like dojo boys, you know what I mean?
Suzuki's first match was on March 14th.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, 2 weeks. Norma Smiley may have been in there, too. I don't know if Gaijin worked in the dojo, but he was there.
Yeah, and Mark Rush. Was he in UWF or UWFI? Or just UWFI?
He was in UWF at this time period. Yeah, they were working shows.
And then the UWF dojo foreigners, Mark Silver and Billy Scott, were they here or were they UWFI?
UWFI.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. All right, moving on to Mexico, and really the only thing going on this week, since we only have really one major promotion, UWA is still around, but we don't have a whole lot of stuff on them, is a big show at Arena Mexico on March 31st. We had Angel Azteca and Atlantis beating El Dandy and El Tejano to retain their Mexican national tag titles in what sounds like a fucking awesome match. And Caballeros contra Caballeros, although it was one person got shaved. Los Infanales, Masacre, MS1, and El Satanico beat Fabuloso Blondie, Ken Timms, Rick Patterson, and Mike Stone. Satanico went over Stone. Stone got his head shaved.
Who's Mike Stone?
Mike Stone. Hold on a second. Talk about that tag match real quick, probably, and how great it was.
A lot of those, not necessarily Tejano, but a lot of those guys worked together in 1990, you know, when El Dandy was at his peak, and they had some incredible matches together. And I would think that this would have aired on Galavision, but all the tapes we have of Galavision start around, when is it, like November? When a certain person...
We have March.
Most of it starts in... The continuous stuff starts at the end.
Yeah, but we have March, and...
Oh, we do. So is this match?
We had the build up to this.
Hmm.
We don't have the particular match itself.
It's probably out there somewhere in the universe, but.
Yeah. And they were La Maquina Gringa. That was the trios team.
An awesome name.
Yeah.
The Gringo Machine.
Yeah. The Gringo Machine. So yeah, we have the March 5th, 12th, and 19th television.
Because those two teams having a title match.
Yeah, I'm trying to see.
Because now I really want to see it. And
that tag match may be another deal, though. I'm checking to make sure.
So is this like, when did they start doing the big annual March show anyway? Because it seems like this is it for that year.
Yes, we have the tag match.
Oh, we do?
And, okay. Here's my thoughts on the tag match. Yeah, this may be the biggest shame of the footage that we've watched. Is this match, while starting slow, was starting to build to a great stretch run right when Atlantis concussed himself, taking a powerbomb from Tejano, which was pretty bad as everyone looked concerned, especially Tejano. There you go.
Oof. I was going to say, with those guys, I would have like heard about it if it was on tape. So I guess it's on tape, but it falls off the rails.
Now, the week before, the match that built up to it was a different story. We had Angel Azteca, Atlantis, and Blue Demon Jr. against El Dandy, Super Muñeco, and El Tejano. This was about Technicos, which is fun, but you could tell some of the fans would have rather had Technicos versus Rudos so they could boost somebody. Everyone looks solid here, even Damon, and guys like Azteca Muñeco got a chance to shine. They came through. Really good contrast to the bloodbaths and hate-filled matches that we've already seen. This sets up the tag match, blah, blah, blah. So, and, yeah. So, yeah, I mean.
Well, that sucks.
Yep, so that match did exist, but Atlantis concussed himself.
Did they do a rematch, maybe?
Don't know off the top of my head.
Oh, well.
But speaking of tag matches, let's go to Puerto Rico, to the Double Double C, as our friend Eberico calls it. And the Ninja Express, Mr. Pogo and Kensuke Sasaki defeated Huracan Castillo Jr. and Miguel Perez Jr. for the Caribbean tag titles in San Juan on April the 1st, when the Batten Twins turn heel and cost the Puerto Rican team the titles.
Okay, two things here. Now, first, what led to Mr. Pogo leaving New Japan in the first place?
I don't know the real story.
Because he never came back after his learning excursion, right?
No, I think he probably just liked it here.
No, but so what leads to him going to FMW and stuff?
Onita, I guess, booking him.
But what happened with him in New Japan? I would think something did.
Well, I don't know.
And it seems weird that I don't think we know.
What happened to me, Shinji Sakazaki? Sasaki just staying here.
No, but Pogo didn't stay here.
Pogo worked in America and Puerto Rico. In other places, Japan and Canada.
But he didn't stay in the U.S. forever like Shinji Sasaki.
No, but I mean, he stayed overseas. Well, like, you know, there was other Japanese guys that kind of did that too.
But I'm saying he was, well, when did he first leave for the U.S.?
The first I remember hearing his name was in like 80. And he had that run in Florida with Bugs and McGraw in 81.
But then he went back to Japan though. He's in New Japan in like 87. So it's not a learning excursion, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, he went back. Yeah, I mean, so he's going against what you're saying. He went back.
No, but my point being, though, he was with New Japan. So was this through New Japan that he got booked into Puerto Rico, though? Or did he just... That's what I'm trying to figure out. What happened with him in New Japan, either way?
I guess he just left. Okay. I have no idea. He just left.
Now,
Kensuke Sasaki, of course, was a New Japan young boy here.
Now, the other thing, the Batten Twins turning heel, and I think they had been heels in Kansas City before this, right?
Yes, managed by Downtown Bruno.
But that was their true calling, and I feel bad that they didn't get a chance to work as heels someplace bigger.
Yes, they should have done they should have been heels in Memphis. That'd been a great contrast. You know, them in Memphis as heels, they could have done that New Generation video, but as heels.
Now, it could
be like the Fabs were supposed to have been.
Who was it that they had the feud with the hair match? Was that Castillo and Perez?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm trying to remember. So what is it, like the 89 anniversary show where like I remember seeing like the match where like they cover up their heads after they lose their hair and they do the whole game. I mean, those are two guys who were just made to be heels. And they got booked as baby faces because they were good-looking, handsome, or ruggedly handsome twin brothers with the, you know, the paper towel guy look, the brawny paper towel guy.
Yeah, see, the champs, I mean, they had beat Castillo and Perez for their hair first.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was, they beat him for their hair first, and then they got the rematch.
Also, they had a great match as heels at the end of their career against our friend Bo James.
Yes. Yes, they did.
And his cousin, Casey Thunder.
Yes, for Southern States Wrestling, which go to kingofkingsport.com for all your Southern States Wrestling needs.
Yep.
Because he has all that stuff. Anyway, we'll finish up Puerto Rico. Jonathan Holliday won the WWC Junior Heavyweight title from Ricky Santana on April the 2nd in Aguadilla. Which the reason that change was because Ricky Santana's coming to America to work for the NWA.
Yep. And
Ricky Santana, that's a guy who he should have been so much more in the business. I feel like he came along at the wrong time. I think if he would have come around 10 years later,
even 5 years later,
5 years, yeah, 10, I think definitely he would have been a much bigger star in a bit.
5 years later, he does a little bit better. 10 years later, it does a lot better because of his size.
Yeah, he could talk. I mean, he had a good look. He was really good in Portland. If you've never seen him in Portland, check him out there. I mean, well, just like Dave Sierra was great in Portland. Yep. That's Dave Sierra's greatest work is in Portland. But, yeah, Ricky Santana was really good. Really good. It's a shame that more people haven't seen his greatness. Of course, Puerto Rico, he was awesome.
And Mexico.
And Mexico as well.
I wonder why he didn't – he did well in EMLL. I wonder why he didn't stay there longer.
Probably money related.
Yeah.
I would think. Him and Sierra were back and forth with WCW in different incarnations. So.
The Barrio Brothers.
The Barrio Brothers, yeah. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. Let the place to be boys pay the bills. And when we come back to America, to the Dirty South, and Master of Pain. A guy that has a big match this weekend at WrestleMania. Well, this last week.
Happened already.
Yeah, yesterday, a guy who had a huge match yesterday at WrestleMania.
That he may or may not have won and or lost.
Yeah, will win his first major title. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here. On the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickerstaff, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with good old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back. And check out all those shows that you just heard advertised in that sweet ad. Now, for us, if you want to support us here Between the Sheets, go to tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon. Whenever you make any purchases on Amazon.com, make sure you go there. Make sure you put the items in your cart there.
After
you go to the link, because if you already have stuff in your cart and you go to the link and do the buy, then that won't count to help us out. So make sure that you do your shopping from that link directly.
Doesn't cost extra.
No extra cost. We get a little percentage of what you buy, and it helps us out with research that we need to make this show better, because we have gaps in newsletters that we need to fill. So
on eBay right now that we should probably get.
Yes. So if you want to hear shows about years that we can't do, then you need to get on the stick and help us out. So
donate on PayPal. I don't think you have one set up. If you wanted to send money specifically to use towards us going to newsletters, I have the whole PayPal.me set up so I can.
Well, I mean, I can use mine if necessary. I can give mine out.
Well, I'm just saying. So if you, for me, I have the whole PayPal.me thing set up. So if you can go to PayPal.me/DavidBix.
Go there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If it's for the, you know, if you want to earmark it so we can get the newsletters, just say that. Just say that in the thing, in the comments.
There you go. So if you want to go that route, you can go that way. Or if you just want to mail us money, no, we're not going to give our addresses out in the air. But all for the betterment of this show. If you love us, support us. That's what I say. Now, moving on to Memphis, Tennessee, and the Continental Wrestling Association, as they were known at this time, CWA. And interesting television show this week on April the 1st is Robert Fuller did an interview on television saying that he was after Jeff Jarrett because he claimed that his father, Jerry Jarrett, stole the territory from his father, Buddy Fuller, 10 years ago. And that the territory was technically his because his grandfather, Roy Welch, owned the promotion. The week after, Jeff Jarrett would come out with a piece of paper saying his father bought the territory legally from Buddy Fuller. Of course, that didn't happen in our week. Robert Fuller's promo did. And I think we have Robert maybe or maybe not under the influence talking about such a deal here.
Not under the influence. Sure.
I said maybe, maybe not. We don't know.
Question before we go to this. Is this the first time that it was ever acknowledged on television that the Fullers were the Welches, that Buddy Fuller was his grandpa, and thus that
Buddy was his father.
Was his father, that Roy was his grandfather. Yeah. I mean, that Buddy was Roy's son, and thus that Robert and Ron were Roy's grandpa.
I don't know if I can make a definite statement on that.
Obviously, when Bo hears this, he will answer that question.
Bo James will tell us, or our good buddy Mark from Memphis Wrestling will tell us, or something like that. So, but anyway, we got the promo. So listen to the greatness of Robert Fuller.
About it, baby, because what's going to happen is I'm going to end Jeff Jarrett's career with this chain right here that all three of those boys are going to pay because the Mason-Dixon made a terrible mistake when you took Jeff Jarrett as your partner, baby.
Robert, wait, I don't understand. This has been going on for over a year. You broke his arm. You broke his Coke bottles over. What is this? What did Jeff do to you? I don't recall him doing anything to you.
Something, mister. I get real personal with you, but this is not a personal thing here. What I'm talking about is I'm talking about the darndest six-man tag that ever came down. I'm talking about chaining us together and finishing that stinking puck.
Robert, go ahead and tell him a story. Tell him.
That's Dutch.
I don't understand. We don't understand. Wait a minute. Tell him the truth. Tell him.
Tell him the truth, Robert.
Tell him we went to Huntington, West Virginia that day. Tell him the whole thing.
Huntington, West Virginia?
Tell him.
Pretty darn personal, Doug.
Tell him.
You need to get it off your chest.
All right, you keep these idiots. I am going to tell you the story.
Okay.
You listen real close.
All right.
Because I'm going to tell you straight. I'm not going to add no lies. I'm not.
He's shooting.
From the truth 1 ounce. I'm going to look right into this camera and tell you exactly what happened. That my grandfather used to own this whole darn outfit. I'm talking about Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, all around. My grandfather, that's right.
That's
Roy
true.
Welch.
That's true.
One time, one of the finest men that ever crawled in a wrestling ring.
That's
and
right.
Then again, later on, the greatest promoter to ever promote a wrestling match.
That's right.
I'm talking about Roy Welch, my grandfather. Well, old Roy, he's laying up there right now in Dyer, Tennessee, and he's laying in his grave. He's not here no more, but he's laying face down, if you know what I'm talking about. The reason he's face down is because of everything that's happened here. He's had to turn over in his grave. Now, don't take that lightly, because I'm going to tell you why he turned over. Because when my grandfather rode up and down these roads and was getting older and maybe a little bit senile and maybe not as able to carry himself along the road, here come a young fella up named Jerry Jarrett. And Jerry Jarrett, just starting his wrestling career, said, "Oh, Mr. Welch, I'll be more than proud to be able to haul you up and down the road." You know what I'm talking about out there, Jerry Jarrett. that Jerry Jarrett rode down the road with him. He yessered him. He con-manned him. He saw that he was senile, and he had a weakness, and he used it against him. And I'm talking about used it against him well enough that half of that area that I just explained to you went right to Jeff Jarrett. I went to Jerry Jarrett. Now, what was supposed to have happened is there's one man that was entitled to have that, and that man was my father, Buddy Fuller. That man was the son of Roy Welch, who deserved and was supposed to have what was coming to him, the five-state area. Now, you have to realize something.
What are you saying?
What I'm saying is that stinking con man, lying, good-for-nothing jerk. I'm saying Jerry Jarrett is a thief. That's what I'm saying. And that he conned my grandfather in a senile state of mind, and he wound up being pardoned. Let me tell you the whole thing. You asked me, let me tell you. Then Jerry Jarrett become partners with what was my father. And then they had nothing but problems between them. The reason they had nothing but problems between them is because of Jerry Jarrett and all of his cronies that hung around him. And because he's the greatest liar that ever lived. He's the greatest con man and cheat and thief. And that's exactly what happened to my father. He got conned, cheated, lied to, and his territory stole away from him. It belongs to one man now, and that's supposedly Jerry Jarrett. And let me tell you something. If you think for one second, that punk Jeff Jarrett is going to get one inch of what belonged to my grandfather, or belonged to my father, or now belongs to me, you can take it and stuff it, baby, because you wanted to know it. Now you hear it. I'm going to turn around. I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. Jarrett, you lying, conniving, con man, stinking thief. Your boy is going to pay the toll of a lifetime, baby. And that's death if it has to be. That I'm going to see. I'm going to see, just as sure as Dutch said it right here. I'm going to see that what rightfully should be mine is going to be mine. The whole darn thing is going to be Robert Fuller's, daddy. And I'm going to see it happen. And if I have to put that punk in the hospital, if I have to order him a nice long casket, I don't care what it takes. But that punk is not going to have what my grandfather meant for me to have. And he's laying up there right now. My grandfather and my grandmother, face down in their grave. I'm telling you, we're going to take care of it. And it's not going to stay that way. You asked me, I told you, I'm going to change it. You tell him, Ronnie Gossett, they're out of it.
Robert's animated as hell, boy. I tell you that.
A lot of half-truths. Truth certainly don't tell you the whole truth, but a lot of times, let me tell you. Well, at least they're out of here. Let's get them in the ring right now. We've got a.
Of course, Lance Russell had been gone now for a month, and Dave is now the host of the show. But that is an angle there that pretty much only works in either Memphis or Continental.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot run that angle in WWF. You cannot run it in NWA. That is an angle where only works where people know the families.
Although, to be clear, though, I think I wasn't sure how specific you were being, but it's also the type of angle. Even with different players, it would not work anywhere other than Memphis or Continental.
No. You know, and there is a lot of truth behind what was said there. And, of course, Jerry Jarrett and Buddy Fuller were partners together for about 3 years there.
Jarrett Welch Promotions.
Jarrett Welch Promotions, and there are different stories on how that fell apart, so we won't go into that, but, and, I mean, this is used, and of course, Nick Gulas would show up soon in a promo with Robert Fuller, you know, or somehow Jerry Jarrett stole it from Nick Gulas, so, a lot of stuff going on there, but what are your thoughts about that promo, Vicks?
It kind of sounds like a babyface promo at times, just the way he's cutting it.
Yeah, you would think. You would think.
And the way he's all hyped up. I mean, some of it sounds like he'll... Also, it's weird seeing him dressed a lot like Colonel Robert Parker.
Yes, he would dress like that a good bit in this time period. Now let's talk about who the stud stable were.
Wow, right. He was spending his money on a lot of things during this time period.
Yeah, I know. At this moment, the stud stable consisted of Robert, Dutch Mantell, and Action Jackson.
You forgot Miss Sylvia.
And Miss Sylvia, of course. And Jimmy Golden had left and went back to Continental, and Brian Lee was about to be joining. But, yeah, that's your stud stable at this time and place. But that wasn't even the biggest angle in this show. As Master of Pain, who we all know and love as The Undertaker, Mark Calloway.
Undertaker doing a ex-con gimmick.
Yeah. Beating Jerry the King Lawler on the show to win the Unified Heavyweight title. This came about as Lawler wanted to know how Ronnie Piazza got a job on the TV show when the station said they didn't hire him. And Danny Marlin said he didn't hire him either, so they couldn't fire him. They still wanted to remove him from the building, but Gossett hit Lawler. And when Lawler went to pound on him, Gossett told him that if he defended his title on television against either Dutch or Master Payne, he could wrestle him later on. Lawler agreed, of course, against Master Payne. Dutch came out, but Eddie Marlin had him escorted out of the building. Dutch fought security. Dutch eventually gave the nightstick to Gossett, who gave it to Master Payne, who used it on Lawler to win a title. Gossett also got some shots in on Lawler after the match. But the whole deal here is Ronnie P. Gossett and the greatness of him. And we have the audio right here.
Now let me make sure I get it queued up to the right part. Now, by the way, wasn't it also that Master of Pain had been in prison with Dutch?
I think that was alluded to, yes.
So should I start before Gossett joins in? Where do I go here exactly?
Just find a spot. I mean, because all this stuff is stemming from the stuff going on. So there's no real proper start of everything, I guess.
Okay. I mean, I see a wacky camera angle with other people coming over, maybe Eddie Marlin, about 28 minutes. So let's try there. Actually, wait, I forgot to unmute it. There we go.
Go down, and they're going to go down hard, and it's because of you, baby.
There's a stud.
Here comes Lawler and Eddie Marlin.
Yep.
See, so I found the right spot.
There you go. And he's got his. That's why you're you.
You guys. Okay, if you don't mind, you know, we have sat back here, not just today, but for several weeks now, and we have watched this big fat tub of, well, for lack of a better word, I'll say lard, Ronnie Gossett, come out here and try to make a shambles out of this wrestling program. And now these are just a few of the letters that have come in. And just to take the one off the top, Eddie was just showing me. He says, "Dear Eddie Marlin, would you please explain to us regular wrestling fans just why you have that big fat slob sitting out there beside Dave Brown, insulting him as well as the others?" The letters go on and on. This is just a few that came in this morning. And you know, as I was looking at these, I asked Eddie Marlin. I said, "Eddie, why would you hire a big fat idiot announcer like this?" Eddie, you might tell me what you said at that point?
I didn't hire him, Lola. I did not hire him.
Now, Eddie Marlin didn't hire this guy, so immediately, I said, "Well, why would the TV station hire a big fat ugly announcer like this? Dave, you work at the TV station. Why would they?"
"We didn't hire him."
Obviously, what has happened is there's been a little misunderstanding, and Ronnie Gossett, you are obviously a little bit smarter than I gave you credit for, because you have wormed your way out here without being hired by either the promoter or the television station. And so what it boils down to is you really don't work here, Ronnie Gossett. You really don't have any business out here. And Eddie said, since he didn't hire you, he can't fire you. But Eddie, you can't tell him that we don't want him on the show anymore, can't you?
That's right, Ronnie Gossett. As of right now, you will not be on the show, so you can hit the road, Ronnie Gossett. He didn't hire you, and I didn't hire you. You can go.
Let me tell you something, you old fossil. Evidently, he's got you in his back pocket, too. You can't fire me.
No, you're right. You're right. He's not firing you. He's telling you to get the heck off this show, because as of right now, you have no more business here. Is that right? That's exactly right. Bye-bye, fatso.
Hey, what's up, Gary?
Tax Lawler, and his hat flies off.
Yeah.
Doesn't really work, though.
Watch it. Got a whole bunch of them. I'll tell you what. I don't care how many of them
there. Come on, Gossett. Lawler, you punk. You want me? You got me. You want me?
Yeah,
baby, you got me, you punk.
Takes his jacket off. Takes his tie off.
And I've had enough of you to last me for an eternity. You punk. You punk.
If you don't get out of the announcer, if you want to be on this show, if you're not an announcer, then you're a wrestler. So get in here, Fetso, and let's see it.
Take your shirt off, whale. From a fan.
He starts unbuttoning it.
Yeah, some of you guys stick around, he says. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, kind of hang out.
If you can back up what you say, let's go right here. Come on.
Let me tell you something, you idiot. You're good at challenging commentators. You're good at hand-picking your opponents. And you're good at picking who you're going to defend that rinky-dink belt you got against. You go completely out of the country. You have to hand-pick those slant-eyed Japs over there.
Oh, my God.
Let me tell you something, Lawler. I'm standing next to two men, and I use the word men, something that you don't know what it means.
Yes.
And I tell you...
Okay, I have to ask. Was he going to say, and I use those words loosely and realize that was the opposite of what he meant?
Yes.
It sounded like it, didn't it?
Yes.
Win, lose, or draw, you take on one of these guys, and then you can have me in the ring. Win, lose, or draw, and you put that belt on the line. I want to see you defend the belt because it'll be a first. I've never seen you defend that belt.
Well, you're not going to get in the ring. Is that what you're telling me, Gossett? You want to jump somebody from behind. You want to run that big fat mouth, and now you don't want to get in here and back it up. Is that
He's
right?
afraid. He always has been. He's a complete idiot.
Let me tell you one thing, Lawler. Wrestle me, win, lose, or draw. You can get a match here, but you put the... I'll wrestle the master of pain, but put the... If you want him that bad...
Hey, let me tell you what, Gossett. Win, lose, or draw, you get in the ring with me.
You got it, you punk. I'll get in the ring with you.
You hear that, Eddie? All right, either one of you jerks, let's go. Get in there.
And then we have the match, you know, from there. And
the master of pain will take you on, Lawler. But wait a minute. Let me tell you something. Before he gets in the ring, I want a contract because I don't believe that moron on oath. I don't believe that old fossil Eddie Marlin. I want a contract. Now, you get that contract. You get it over here. We make it nice and legal. You understand?
Get a contract. Come on.
We're talking about...
They're talking about a title match now.
Get in the ring.
Talking about... Eddie.
You've got Eddie Marlin. All Eddie Marlin is a little dummy.
They're talking about putting a
12-10-acre bargain. That's exactly right.
We better take a break.
Yeah, we better take a break, Dave.
Get the contract. We'll take a break. We'll be back out here,
you goof.
Ronnie P. Gossett, folks. I mean, you just...
Coming soon, Renegades, Cyclone, Stampede.
That's a Robert Fuller booking idea that went the Continental after he left. But
I don't even know about that. Who were they?
Yeah. No, that was a gimmick match.
That was a gimmick.
It was like the
Renegades Rampage Cyclone.
It was like the Royal Rumble. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if you haven't seen Ronnie P. Gossett, we talk about him on the show. I mean, all this stuff's on YouTube. The full television shows from Evansville, pretty much all of them from this era are on YouTube. You have to watch it because he is just hilarious.
Is that basically everything that our old buddy Trent taped? Is that on YouTube now?
Pretty much, yeah.
So pretty much end of 85 through late 1990?
Yeah, a lot of good stuff's on there. So you gotta check it out. And it's just great stuff. Well, we talk about Continental. Let's move on to Continental. And this isn't on YouTube right now, but it may be soon. Our good buddy Bo James will probably load it up. On there... April 1st television show, Dirty White Boy Tony Anthony bought time and held a funeral for the promotion's mascot, the Continental Cat. They held a procession with the other heels carrying the casket into the ring, which one of those heels was Masahiro Chono, with Dr. Don Pritchard delivering the eulogy. During the eulogy, someone came to the ring and told the funeral party that the party patrol Johnny and Davy Rich had driven off with the hearse. I guess they want to go pick up some dates for the evening. The heels ran out of the building after the hearse, which saw Wendell Cooley, Danny Davis, and Todd Morton go to ringside, where Davis put on the costume and jumped in the casket. After the heels returned, Anthony looked in the casket and was slapped by the dead cat, causing him to go into a panic. And the heels tried to catch the cat, who ran away. God damn, I want this on YouTube right now.
I've never seen this. I need to see this work out.
This is, and Bill Dundee is the booker here. This is Bill Dundee stuff, and man, it sounds fantastic. I mean, we really can't even comment on this, really, because we haven't seen it. But
yeah, you have never seen this?
I do not remember this at all. I really don't.
Was Continental still on?
It might have been. I know in 89 they did not air it anymore on there, but it might have been this time. But yeah, hilarious. Hilarious stuff.
So what was it? Did he look like Wildcat Willie, kind of?
I don't know. I've never
seen him at all.
It's just... It's
so
just,
they
just,
put the... Wait, so did they put the empty cat costume in the casket? The casket, or did they... Or was it an empty casket and then Danny Davis jumps in?
Well, you never saw the casket until Danny Davis went in there.
Oh, they didn't see... Wait, so did the fans see...
I guess not.
Danny Davis get in?
Yeah, the fans saw it because...
Okay,
in the,
yeah.
He put the suit on and got in the casket.
In front of the fans. Okay, I need
to see. Maybe it was an empty casket. I don't know. We got to see it first. But
I really need to see this.
Yes. Now let's move on further south to Florida Championship Wrestling. This is Dusty Rhodes' promotion. And Big Steel Man is rumored to be heading to the WWF very soon to be the next monster fed to Hulk Hogan.
Well,
part was true. Big Steel Man, of course, became Tugboat Thomas.
Hulk Hogan's best friend.
Hulk Hogan's best friend.
Who then had some kind of completely never reported, what's the word I'm looking for? Discipline issue and lost his push.
Yep.
And that has never, ever come out, has it?
Nope.
Other than we know that something happened, right?
Yeah. He was gone for a while and he came back.
But without his push.
Which we talked about on one of the early episodes of Between the Sheets. Because it was around SummerSlam 90.
And gets replaced by Big Boss Man.
Big Boss Man. But, yeah, this is...
WWE Hall of Famer, the Big Boss Man.
Yeah. Big Steel Man was feuding with Dusty at this time, of course. So that was the big angle. And Dusty, speaking of Dusty, the group lost its television in Orlando to the NWA. And they were promoting the big show in Orlando coming up in the next month. So, not good timing for them. And actually, that was a pretty fun promotion from what we got, you know, the television we got.
We don't have a lot.
We don't have a lot, but it's pretty fun.
It's a mixed bag, though. I mean, Scott Hall is the word humongous.
Yeah, you got DDP with Gordon as the announcers. Nasty Boys are there. You know, you got, you know, a mixed bag of things going on. Different guys coming in.
Lou Perez. You know,
yeah.
It's not a Florida independent promotion between 1989 and 1994 without Lou Perez.
Yeah. Lawler came in. I mean, there's different guys that came in and out of there. So Dick Slater. It was a fun promotion. And now we transfer from that to Potpourri. And boy, is there some fun here. Dennis Coraluzzo. I was hoping you were going to do
it. You didn't prepare me for it. Do it again.
I was hoping. No.
Start again.
Dennis Coraluzzo. And Larry Sharp had a very successful show on April the 1st in Sewell, New Jersey. I'm sure at the Rec Center. Drawing a sellout of 1,600 fans with an $18,000 gate.
Whoa! So this show... promoted by Dennis Coraluzzo and Larry Sharp, drew a bigger gate than the Clash of the Champions at the Superdome.
Yes. For this.
By 20%.
For this lineup.
And at what may very well be that dump that CZW ended up running at.
Yeah. For this lineup. Sharp came out of retirement to beat Joe Daniels, by blood stoppage. Plus, you had Don Morocco beating Davey G. The Cheetah, Ted Petty, fighting Tony Stetson to a draw. Sean O'Reilly beating Brian O'Reilly in a lumberjack match.
Are those the guys that were in Memphis?
Yes. And Johnny Rods worked this show as a manager. And it did 20% better than Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat.
At the Superdome.
At the Superdome.
At the Clash of Champions.
At the Clash of Champions.
On Thanks, George Scott.
They should have had Dennis Corluzzo. We're booking WCW. NWA.
They absolutely should have.
We would imagine those fun gimmicks. Woof.
And how, story, would, how is
that? Think about all your the great Dennis of the days you could have had with him working with that type of roster.
Now, which newsletter was this in? The Observer?
Yes. Yeah, it was in the Observer.
How I'm actually surprised that I have never heard this comparison made before.
And nobody's probably even thought about it.
Was it in the same issue or was it in the following week's issue?
It was in that time range, yeah. All right, let's go to Mark Madden now. He ran a big piece in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette on wrestling on April the 1st, and it has some great lines. Lutez said, I'm 72, and I've had total hip replacement. I could beat Hulk Hogan right now in a wrestling match. Then we had Jim Cornette, who said, if I was wanted by the FBI or the Mafia wanted to kill me, I'd want to be on the Clash of the Champions because no one knows when it is, where it is, or who is on it. It's a well-kept secret. And we had Jack Petrick, who said, we offered Dusty Rhodes a nice scenario if he'd stay, where he would have had to turn heel and lose matches, but he didn't want to do either of those things. He thought Starrcade was indicative of the fact that we plan on using decisive pinfall endings, which is something NWA fans haven't seen in a long time. It's not easy, though, to convince these guys they have to lose sometimes. Any thoughts on those quotables there from these three?
Cornette was definitely the winner here, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's great stuff.
And he says this while Axe still technically being under the employ of WCW.
I know, and Lutez, we heard that stuff from him, which he probably could have done it, but, you know, it's like Terry Funk said earlier.
That bodybuilder bass player.
I know. Eddie Crawford, also known as the Snowman... had a petition filed against him by his son, Memphis State, back then, now just Memphis, running back Xavier Crawford, for protection in a Shelby County Circuit Court. In the petition, Xavier claimed that he was assaulted and repeatedly struck by his father. Mm. Now, we've all seen the Snowman. He would never be a guy to do something like that, Vix. I mean, he is, you know, a calm... you know, level-headed type of guy.
Sure.
Now, this is a year before his great Memphis angle. So, I guess they got all that stuff taken care of before he went back on television. I don't know.
What was the name of the newspaper that he, the black newspaper that he'd go to advance his agenda? That they something Defender, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Bluff City Defender? Something like that. I don't know.
I don't know. Rob Russin sent out faxes over the week to virtually every independent station in the country, pitching his new Pro Wrestling Report show, which is like Pro Wrestling This Week. Reportedly, the program is hosted by Mick Karch, and they already have a time slot with WGBO in Chicago, featuring highlights from independent groups across the country.
I don't think this ended up happening as a broadcast television show, but didn't Pro Wrestling Report become the name of Karch's access show for a time?
Yes.
It did. Later, Slick Mick's Body Slam Review?
Yes. Now, an indie show in Denver drew 600 fans with Buddy Rose beating Dennis Stamp, Misty Blue beating Cat LaRue, Jim Brunzel beating Colonel DeBeers by DQ, and Greg Boyd going to a DDQ with Leon White, of course, Vader. Jimmy Snuka was supposed to work this show, but he was pulled by the WWF for reasons which we'll talk about later.
Now, by the way, is Rob Russin becoming a, at least for this era, a Bam Bam Bigelow type of mainstay on Between the Sheets?
Yes, you could say that. He's made quite a few appearances on our shows. Yes. Buddy Rose and Dennis Stapp. That sounds like an interesting match in 1989, doesn't it?
Indeed. Jim Brunzel and Colonel DePierre's.
Well, think about this. Dennis Stapp and Pentagon Jr. is going to be on the same show for AIW next month.
Against each other?
We can only hope. Well, I know he's doing autographs with Veda Scott, so... Wow. All right, since we were in Denver, we'll go to the AWA. And the AWA, this is from the Torch. The AWA is apparently negotiating with ESPN to get a regular time slot soon, along with regaining their old afternoon slot. They're also going to be able to advertise upcoming dates on the program, which they had never been able to do before.
Oh, my God. I did not know that.
That's right. Yeah. ESPN also will allot them one slot for a live TV special this year.
That
which
didn't
never
happen.
Happened. But yeah, Vic. So, I mean, I didn't think about that either when I typed this up. I was like, that's right. They never promoted house shows on that show. Never. Like you would expect. I mean, I think they would, you know, if there was a show like WrestleRock or something like that, they would, you know, you would get promoted or a Super Clash. But as far as like regular house shows, nope.
They wouldn't have like the here comes the AWA on tour type of thing, even.
No, not like Turner had with, you know, World Championship Wrestling.
Or even WWF with the thing doing
yeah.
the World Wrestling Federation on tour and then the like the eagle flying through or whatever it was.
Yeah. And, you know, they got back on ESPN and it wasn't long after this the Team Challenge series got going. So.
Which we discussed on a previous edition of Between.
That's right.
Did we talk about that or did I just tweet about I'm trying to remember if we ended up at that.
Well, we talked about the Team Challenge stuff. We talked about the beginning of it.
Did we talk about the actual origin of the team? We did, right?
Yeah.
We did end up talking about it.
Yeah. Now, the first TV that was shown, I think, on ESPN in this new deal was when Bad Company lost the AWA tag titles to Patera and Rangins, which is a really good match. So
I've never seen that. So what? But it sounds like maybe Patera's best post-prison match?
One of them. Now, more AWA news. Johnny Ace was supposed to come to work. He was supposed to come to work here, but he will be going to the NWA instead. Now, we could have not, like I said, it goes from earlier. You know, we might not have the Dynamic Dudes if he works in the AWA. They could have put Johnny Ace and Tom Zink together in matching white tights. So, it could, I mean, just imagine. And that's his home, Minnesota, so he would have been back at home.
I guess so.
All right, let's go further west here to the Pacific Northwest. And Carl Stiles, Killer Carl Stiles, beat the Grappler on April the 1st in Portland to win the Northwest Heavyweight title. For those of you, I mean, yeah, this sounds, you know, ridiculous. Carl Stiles, you have to watch Portland from this era to get it. Because Carl Stiles was amazingly over. The upcoming Exile on Bad Street on the 1986-1987 Continental, Carl Stiles gets talked about on that show a little bit more in depth. So you'll be able to get more of a vibe on that show. But you have to watch it to get the reason why he was so over. It was amazing. And Roddy Piper's partly to do with it, but
because he was booking.
Well, he was booking and he had a big deal on camera with him. So, yeah, Portland was amazing at this time. And also on this show, Scotty the Body, Scott Levy, starts some tension between the Southern Rockers, leading to a match where Scotty used brass knucks on Peterson and then put them on Dahl's hand to make it look like Dahl punched out Peterson. And this deal went for a few weeks before the Southern Rockers eventually, you know, figured out what he was doing and they, you know, became tag partners again, whatever. But
wow, it didn't actually lead to them splitting.
No, and Portland was so fun. Portland was just like Memphis in this time period. Roddy Piper and Lynn Ditton were the bookers, and it was just really, really cool. Really cool to watch. Lots of great talkers here, like Buddy Rose, Alma Jarrell, Dave Sierra. There's lots of great talkers in and out of this from Piper, Art Barr becoming Beetlejuice. So,
did you say Grappler?
The Grappler. Yep. Lots of great stuff going on here. All right. Down south to World Class Championship. Oh, and Scotty, real quick. We got to talk about Scotty the Body. Scotty the Body was doing the heel announcer shtick with Don Koss, who was the play-by-play
guy. Oh, my God. I have to interrupt.
That's not who you think it is. I know what you're getting at.
No, I didn't think that Kalisto's significant other was Sexy Star.
Yeah, it's somebody wearing a mask.
I was just going to say, no, I didn't think it was an actual
luchadora.
I just put on the Hall of Fame red carpet show, and Kalisto's significant other is wearing a mask.
Yeah, she's wearing a Sexy Star mask. Sexy Star.
Is that a Sexy Star mask? I only saw it for a second.
Yeah, Sexy Star is with her husband, Johnny Gonzalez, for his fight tonight. So there you go. Anyway, back to this. World Class Championship Wrestling. Kevin Von Erich has been released from duty as he was missing more shows than he was scheduled for. And the rumors are that Kerry may soon be joining him.
I'm going to guess that's not literal.
Those guys, man. Oh, just a total train wreck. We've talked about them on this show so many times, but Jesus. And they own this promotion. Well, they weren't owners at this time.
No, they were.
Partly.
They each own 20%.
Yeah, partly, but it wasn't like it was.
Yes. Meanwhile, there's Randy Orton and his wife. If it ends up being anything like last year, I'm going to need a cigarette by the time they're off camera.
His wife looks like Minnie Fran Drescher. But yeah, Kevin and Kerry were just total messes, and they would appear on television at random times in this time period, just whenever they felt like it, I guess, or whenever they were in condition to perform. But Kerry had some good matches in '89 towards the back half.
I'm trying to remember.
Harsh Bulba.
Yes.
The Punisher, Undertaker's other gimmick. Mm-hmm. You know, in this time period. Soul Taker, I think, was around this time period as well.
New WWE Hall of Famer, the Soul Taker.
Yeah, so it was easy, interesting, but yeah, Kevin, what a mess. All right, P.Y. Chuhai, the great Phil Hickerson, Samurai, of course, Shinya Hashimoto, and Shogun, Shinji Sasazaki, are all supposedly head of the world class and were probably managed by Buddy Roberts.
So was P.Y., he had already been P.Y. Chuhai in Memphis?
Yes.
I forgot about that.
Now, one of these happened. One of them came. He never was managed by Buddy Roberts. Because PYGI came in with...
World Class President Tojo Yamamoto.
World Class Championship Wrestling President Tojo Yamamoto. Samurai, of course, went to New Japan and became the megastar, Shinya Hashimoto.
When was the Dome show?
April. And then Shogun, of course, became a great chef.
Yes, he fell in love. Married, stayed in Nashville.
P.Y. Chuhai, your thoughts on that gimmick? It's something that never could be done today.
No. Now, for those who have only seen him in Dallas, in Memphis, it's just, isn't it hilarious? Phil Hickerson is pretending to be Japanese.
Yeah.
In World Class... kind of play it straight.
Yes, they do play it straight.
I mean, you'll have Mark Laurent saying, well, he doesn't look like any Oriental I've ever seen. But other than that, he's played straight. He is a legitimate Oriental assassin.
Mm-hmm. The world class caught some heat this weekend by the excessive bloodshed by Percy Pringle in the angle where Devastation Incorporated destroyed him with an iron bar after the Eric Embry Killer Brooks match. Yeah, they had to pixelate this blood because it was so much, but Percy really tapped a gusher here.
They had to pixelate a lot of things while Eric Embry was booking.
Yeah. But man, was he bleeding. And this was a fun era, World Class. This is their comeback.
This was a great program. I mean, Eric Embry, he made himself the top star and very Kerry Von Erich in the process, but he did a great job as booker.
Yeah, they had just done the reinstatement angle, you know, and the fan letters and all this other stuff. Frank Dusick was good in his role and all this. Yeah, it was really, really fun television. The best television they had in, God, almost 3 years. So, yeah, NXT 89 World Class. Go check that out whenever you can find it. YouTube, I think there's stuff on there, but go check it out. And now let's close out with the World Wrestling Federation and WrestleMania time. So there's no events this week, just WrestleMania, but there's a lot of stuff coming out.
So different, isn't it? That
yeah.
To that it used to be like, oh, you have all this time off around WrestleMania. Now,
yeah, they gave them a week off and then like the week after off. So I mean, it was a lot of time off for these guys, which they needed.
Wait, are Lita and Corey Graves dating?
I don't know. Anyway, Titan kept up their policy.
You know why I'm asking, right?
I'm trying to get through this show.
I know. It just looks very strange knowing everything.
Yeah, well, that Stary is giving right now something else. He's married with children.
Oh, that's right. I forgot he's
married. Yeah.
Never mind. Let's keep going.
Titan kept up their policy of not allowing any reporters they, quote, don't trust for credentials for coverage of WrestleMania. They believe that they will not hold a post-show press conference as they have in years past. Because even though the admission of wrestling being something other than a sport hasn't hurt them at the box office, they are still very paranoid about allowing their wrestlers any contact with the media, which will no doubt be asking questions and making accusations. Interesting.
It's very interesting, yeah.
And this is the same week that Randy Savage is on Arsenio.
Yeah, should we talk about this for a second?
Yeah, go ahead, because it didn't happen on our week.
How many days out of our week?
It was 2 days before.
I've pimped this before. Just go look it up. It's the appearance of Randy Savage on Arsenio, where he's also there with Morgan Fairchild. I think there are a couple of different versions on YouTube. One's complete, one's not. It is the greatest wrestler talk show appearance you will ever see in your life. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes.
He is just on fire.
Yeah, Randy is great in that whole segment. And Morgan Fairchild's good, too, in her part of it.
Yeah. But. And I guess for once, maybe Arsenio didn't want the stars of the National Wrestling Alliance on. Hell, even if he was watching TV, he may not have realized there was a show that Sunday.
They didn't have nothing to promote. But even with all this, they got the New York Daily News to run a 12-page advertising supplement regarding Mania on the 29th. The area this paper covered ended up doing a 16.2 buy rate, nearly triple the national average. The Chicago Sun-Times also ran a cover story in this weekend, their section on Jesse Ventura, and his picks for Mania, and Chicago did a 7.8 buy rate. Now, the New York Daily News, that section that we're talking about, the area, would have been your neck of the woods, isn't it?
It wouldn't be the entire metro area, but it would be at least New York City and Long Island, yeah.
16.2 buy rate. That's pretty damn strong.
Yeah, 7.8 is pretty strong, too.
Yeah.
This ended up being easily the most successful wrestling pay-per-view up to this point, and then WWF didn't match it for another 9 years.
Nope, and those numbers... For the show, 18,946, 17,500 paid, with a $1.268 million gate, 5.5 national buy rate, which was a disappointment since Jim Troy, one of the higher-ups, was telling everyone that they were getting a 10. They did 2.5 million on closed-circuit buys, with the province of Ontario doing a 92% capacity, which was the biggest. Wow. The Los Angeles Sports Arena sold 6,000 tickets. And the Cow Palace in San Francisco drew a little over 5,000 tickets.
Now,
so that's strong.
When did they announce the Sky Dome for WrestleMania 6?
After this.
Well, now we know why.
Now you know why. Now, as for WrestleMania, the ultimate financial success and high job in the history of this business.
Oh, and we didn't mention the actual buys, which I believe were $750,000.
Yeah. The payoff didn't live up to its hype. In fact, it didn't even live up to the hype of the NWA show. Think about that line by Dave. Well, I thought this was a better show overall than last year's fiasco. It was still a major disappointment. The work rate was far superior to a year ago. And while I have more than a share of dud matches for a supercard, all those who could perform seemed to perform to the best of their ability. We didn't have the steady stream of guys running out of gas in 3 to 4 minutes like last year, or the boredom of a show that never seemed like it would end. This year's WrestleMania was a solid 3.5 hours without an intermission, and a lot less interview time than on previous Titan Big shows. But the biggest problem last year was every bit as evident this year, and maybe more so. The high rollers who go to Trump Plaza ruined the heat and made the matches seem a lot worse than they really were. Once again, they came to see Hulk Hogan and didn't react well to anyone else, nor did anyone seem to get into... So scroll up. The matches of those fans in the first few rows that were evident to those watching the show nationwide. The other major complaint was that Titan's normal job of good booking on the big shows went out the window here. The booking was not only uncreative, with every finish being an overused cliche right on down the line from the opening match back suplex double pin, which they ran to death on the house shows for the past few months. Not to mention George Scott did the exact same finish on his last pay-per-view. To the Hogan leg drop finish, which was inexcusable not only for the lack of creativity in the finish of such a well-hyped match, but also for a long-term success of a promotion. Quote, killing, unquote, Savage off at this time was unforgivable, as he was the first wrestler in years who could draw the mega gates on the non-Hogan shows. I expected a title change, although I don't think that was a good decision either, but a clean pinfall in that situation with the leg drop was something I'd expect more from Fern Gagne or Antonio Inoki than from Titan Sports. Whoa.
Well,
hey, bring in the heat.
Well, if I remember correctly, not only was Savage drawing much better than any non-Hogan shows had ever drawn, but he actually got hotter once he turned heel.
Yes. We talked about this in the last show.
Yeah.
You know, Savage was just, I mean, that was the worst decision they could have made. And I've had people talk about that, you know, on Twitter and other places to me, ask me why I thought that. But you could have went with Savage longer as a champion. I mean, you could have stretched this. I mean, they could have done the title change at SummerSlam or something like that if you're going to do it with Hogan.
You could stretch it out to WrestleMania. Hell, stretch it out to WrestleMania 6. Hell, don't even put it back on Hogan.
And the deal with SummerSlam is you're using no holds barred to pump up the match. So, I mean, you're doing a double sword here. So, I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Definitely should have changed plans. As soon as business started going up after Savage turned, I just don't get how you can't go with the flow there.
Stroking Hogan's ego. That's all it is.
Yeah. This is one of the bigger missed opportunities they've ever had.
Yeah, and this is Hogan screwing Savage. I mean, just a total screw. Just didn't need to happen. And Elizabeth went with Hogan.
Well, and now I wonder if it came up at all, though. Changing the finish.
I don't know. I've never heard of that coming up as a possibility, no.
Me neither.
All right. Well, let's run down some of these matches here. This is a long show.
How many matches do we have on this one? 14 or 15?
Something like that. 3, 5, 7, 9, 14. All right, Hercules beat King Haku in that hot opener in 6:53. Howard Finkel accidentally referred to Haku as King Tonga.
Wonderful.
Well, he was King Haku, for a mistake. The Twin Towers, Akeem and the Big Boss Man, defeated the Rockers. Oh, the star rating on the previous match was half a star. This match was a star and three quarters.
I think Dave's underrating that match. That's a really good match.
Yeah, it was a pretty good match. I would be better than that rating. Brutus Beefcake battled Ted DiBiase to a double countout. DiBiase and Virgil shook hands with Donald Trump at ringside before the match. After the match, Beefcake put Virgil to sleeper, followed DiBiase. Both men escaped before Beefcake could use his shears, star and three quarter.
Donald Trump shook hands with Virgil?
Yeah. There's a lot in common between Donald Trump and Ted DiBiase at this time period. They both like, well, I don't know what to say. All right, the Bushwhackers defeated Jacques and Raymond Rougeau when Luke pinned Raymond following the battering ram, double gut buster behind the referee's back. After the bout, Sean Mooney attempted to interview fans near the aisle where the Bushwhackers came up behind him and licked his face. -4 stars. This is Dave's comments on this match. Suffice to say, this was one of the worst matches in modern history of any civilized nation. Monsoon didn't know Luke from Butch. The sheepherder strut is really over, not so much here, but in most places. But I can't describe in words how bad this match was. Let's just say that Paul Jones versus Ivan Koloff was no longer the favorite to win worst match of the year.
Hmm.
Yikes. All right, moving on. Mr. Perfect pinned the Blue Blazer with a forearm blow in the Perfectplex. And this was Perfect's debut wearing the singlet. As yes, he was just wearing regular tights for the first few months of his run as Mr. Perfect. 2.5-star match.
It's the first time he looks like Mr. Perfect.
Yeah, this is the definitive Mr. Perfect look. Next, we got the WrestleMania rap from Run DMC. But Dave said he couldn't understand a single word they said and compared it to Tommy Rich trying to sing an opera.
No comment.
The fans booed the Run DMC announcer at every house show before Mania, and they seemed to know their stuff here. All right. He also said that they were, quote, dead, unquote, meaning they were yesterday's news for those of you who don't follow the rap music scene.
Does that mean that those of us who do follow the rap music scene include Dave?
Well, hey, I will say this. In 1989, this time of period, Run DMC was like Hulk Hogan of rap music. I mean, they were on the downward spiral, downward slide. They were, their peak had come and gone. So Dave does have a point there. But that's just interesting. Tommy Rich trying to sing an opera line. I love it. WF Tag Team Champions Demolition defeated the Powers of Pain and Mr. Fuji in a handicap match. Axe pinned Fuji following the decapitation device at the Fuji accident through Salt and Warlord's face. Dud. Dino Bravo pinned Ronnie Garvin in 4 minutes. Oh, what? I just, reading that makes me sad. Howard Finkel introduced Jimmy Snuka, with Snuka then appearing, coming to the ring, posing for the fans, and then leaving. After the match, Garvin knocked Bravo to the floor, attacked Frenchie Martin, and executed the Garvin stomp. Well, at least he got that. Snuka's first TV appearance after 4-year absence. Dud.
Those are some real good memories, bro.
Good memories. Real good memories. Good memories. All right. And then Frenchie Martin was gone. That was his going away present, as Dino was going with Jimmy Hart.
Poor Dylan.
Yeah, I know. The Brainbusters, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, defeated Strikeforce, Tito Santana, Rip Martel, 9-17, with Anderson pinned Santana following the spike power driver. Late in the bout, Martel walked out on his partner after Santana accidentally hit him with a fine forearm. And after the contest, Gene Oakland conducted a backstage interview with Martel regarding his actions, with Martel claiming he was sick of Santana riding his coattails. This was their first match as a team in 10 months in a 2.5-star match.
It was really that long?
Yeah.
When did Martel come back as a singles?
Well, Martel was working in Puerto Rico early in the year for WWC.
No, but when did he come back to WWF as a singles?
Oh, not too long before this.
So what happened? He was still in WWF, but...
I don't know. He's working WWC.
I didn't even realize he went to Puerto Rico during that. And then,
yeah.
And after all that complaining about how my partner quit on him, he walks out on poor Tito. Should we play his promo?
Yes, please.
Okay. And then I guess we'll also go straight into the next segment after that.
Brainbusters making short work of Tito Santana, although a valiant effort on his part. Right now, let's go to Mean Gene, who's with Martel.
Rick Martel, what kind of an explanation do you have for your actions out there? You left Tito Santana high and dry. You walked away from your tag team partner.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, he just got what he deserved. You know, I'm sick and tired of him. You know, I'm sick and tired of carrying him around. You know, I was doing great when I was since I've been coming to WWF as a single wrestler. But no, Mr. Tito wants to ride my coattail once more.
Mr. Tito, Lords of Pain?
I've been carrying him around for too long already.
Wait a minute, Rick Martel, you're out of line. Strikeforce was supposed to be a team.
I don't want to be associated with that guy. He's a loser. You saw his timing was way off. You're lucky that I'm being a gentleman than I am. I just walked off. That could have been a lot worse for you, Tito Santana.
I think we've heard
I'm
enough.
I'm tired. I'm
Let's
fed
go
up
back
with you.
To you, Gorilla.
Maybe Martel wouldn't be blown up on this promo if he wasn't completely jacked out of his mind.
Yeah,
he is huge. I mean, it's like what we were talking about last week with WrestleMania 4.
Yeah, these guys, a lot of guys were humongous here.
I mean, well, especially for WrestleMania, though, guys.
And Hogan was humongous again here, too.
Peak for WrestleMania.
Yeah, and Rick Martel's first appearance as a heel in, like, close to 10 years. Because he had done heel work in Puerto Rico. So, Next, we get probably the most memorable segment of this whole show. Howard Finkel introduced Roddy Piper for an in-ring Piper's Pit, with Brother Love then appearing, dressed as Piper, and pretending to interview Piper, doing his own impersonation of Piper. And moments later, Morton Danny Jr., scheduled as Piper's guest, appeared and insulted Love until the real Piper was introduced. Piper then spoke with Love, mentioning his kilt, before eventually taking the kilt off to reveal his underwear. With Love then running backstage, Piper then turns attention to Downey, who the two insults in the other. As Downey repeatedly blew smoke at Piper's face, Piper eventually asked for his own cigarette, then doused Downey with a fire extinguisher. When he turned back around, Piper then left ringside with Downey close behind, but held back by officials, and Piper's first appearance here in 2 years.
Okay, so should we explain Morton Downey Jr.? Because it was such a short-lived thing, and I'm trying to figure out if we actually need to explain who he is.
Well, Morton Downey Jr. was a talk show host who was very controversial. I wouldn't say he was Springer before Springer, but he kind of was in a way. He was the first crash TV talk show guy.
Yes.
I mean, Donahue had some moments, but Morton's show was always like that. And Morton, you know, was smoking that cigarette. And I mean, he was a character. I'll tell you what. I mean, he was great on Stern. But Howard Stern's relationship was awesome. Love and hate, but he was a total, you know, nut job, you know, as a host, and it was crazy. I mean, he was in so much controversies.
But he had such a quick rise and fall, though. It's like, what, he's on for a few months in New York, then the show gets syndicated, becomes a huge hit. Then he, for some reason, decides to fake being attacked by neo-Nazis in a bathroom.
Yeah, here's some of his controversies. 1984, for KFBK Radio, he used the word Chinaman while telling a joke. His use of the word obsessed portion of a sizable Asian community in Sacramento.
I presume this is the controversy section of his Wikipedia article.
Yeah. One Asian American city councilman called for an apology and pressed the station for his resignation. Downey refused to apologize and was forced to resign, with Rush Limbaugh taking his place. Oh, it's interesting. Downey was sued for allegedly appropriating the words and using to his theme song.
Sorry, I was late there. I didn't expect for that. That at all.
From two songwriters, he was sued for $40 million after bringing this stripper Kelly Everett onto the show and calling her a slut, pig, hooker, and a tramp, claimed she had venereal disease and banged his pelvis against hers. In 1988, he was arraigned on criminal charges for allegedly attacking a gay guest on the show in a never aired segment. Another lawsuit is accused of slandering a newscaster and indecently exposing himself to her and slapping her. He punched Stuttering John during an interview done for the Howard Stern Show, which was on the WOR show, which is hilarious, while also shouting verbal insults at John, referring to him as an uneducated slob. The situation then began to evolve into a brawl between the two until Downey had to be pulled up of John by security. And of course, the entire incident was caught on camera. And when an Inside Edition camera crew approached Downey in 1989 to question him about his involvement in an alleged business scam, Downey grabbed the boom mic and struck the sound man's head with it. But, yeah. Morton Downey Jr. was just it was a product of the era.
Although he also kind of stole Wally George's act.
He stole Wally George's act, but...
Who was the 70s guy that they stole the act from?
Oh, I don't know.
Did you see the Morton documentary that they had?
I haven't seen it.
On CNN a while back?
No. Yeah, sure, only ran from 87 to 89, but he was the guy that created trash television.
Yep.
All right. And if you haven't seen the Brother Love, Roddy Piper, Morton Downey stuff, it's on the network. Go check it out.
So we're not going to play any of it? Or should we at least play Brother Love talking as Piper, or are we just going to skip this?
We're just going to skip. I mean, you haven't seen it. Go check it out.
It's long, too.
It's long. Yeah, you have to see it in context, get everything. And, you know, we're not going to take that long. Yeah. All right, Jake Snake Roberts beat Andre the Giant by DQ with special guest referee Big John Studd. And repeatedly headbutted him as Roberts chased Jay DiBiase and Virgil down the aisle. DiBiase attempted to steal Damian from ringside. After the bout, Roberts slid Damian in the ring, scaring Andre from ringside. Negative 3 stars. So, lots of terrible ratings on the show.
I have a question, though. Did Dave call Andre the Giant embarrassment here?
No. Aww. He said this was awful. Now, the one thing about Piper that Dave mentioned, and it's interesting, he said Piper in one segment went from the hottest free agent in wrestling to just a guy, basically.
I wouldn't agree with that. I would not agree with that at all.
because you got to remember the rumors this time was Piper when I was talking to NWA, because NWA had cross promoted with Portland earlier in the year for show, and Piper was actually on the show, you know, with Flair. So that's it. You know, that's one of the big what ifs for sure. If Piper goes to WWF in 1989, I mean, NWA 1989. All right, Hart Foundation defeated Honky Tonk Man Greg Valentine, Rhythm and Blues Not Yet. When Hart pinned Honky, you have to hit him with the megaphone. The last appearance of the Hart Foundation as a team for 6 weeks. And 9 months later, we get the birth of Rhythm and Blues, 2.5 stars.
Now, this is the beginning of Brett's second aborted singles push.
Yes.
Both now, of which were kind of birthed at WrestleMania.
Now, let's talk about the most interesting stuff in this deal. Was the behind-the-scenes problems before the match with Honky over not wanting to do the job, but this time he did it.
Again.
Lots of speculation from Wim Van Titan that he would either quit or get fired over refusing to do the job. Anyway, this match is better than the sound on paper, given the talents of the four.
What? Wait, so, the talents of the four?
That's what Dave had.
That's an interesting statement.
Yes. All right. Intercontinental Championship. Rick Rude pinned the champion, Ultimate Warrior, to win the title in 9:42. Heenan swept Warrior's leg from under him, held the foot down. Warrior attacked Heenan, dropped him with Gorilla Press Slam, chased Rude backstage. 2.5-star match, which Dave said was a lot better in reality than it sounded on paper. And yes, Dave called the Warrior the Anabolic Warrior. He said, to Warrior's credit, they released four wrestlers, Junk Food Dog, Andre, Bravo, and Jim Duggan, who actually looked worse than he did. This is great. The hardest part was when Warrior had to run to the dressing room and got to those stairs. He was moving like William Conrad would, trying to do a marathon. But thankfully, the camera cut away from his incredible athletic attempt to run stairs before he completely collapsed. Do you know who William Conrad is?
I do, but I'm drawing a blank.
William Conrad played Cannon, it was a TV show Cannon. But he was more known as being the fat man on Jake and the Fat Man. Oh, that's a great line about Dave. William Conrad.
Did Jim actually collapse, though? Did Warrior?
I guess so. Duggan, it went on TV.
Wait a second. We've got enough time. Give me a second. We got to point out that very long walk to the ring they had at these Trump Plaza Boardwalk Hall shows.
Yeah, that was long as hell. Not as long as WrestleMania 3, but...
Long enough that it should have had a cart.
Yeah.
And it made the Jimmy Snuka thing earlier in the show completely interminable.
Yes. And also, we got to mention on this show, too, they did the Jesse Ventura deal again, where Howard Finkel announced him and he posed for everybody, which I still don't get.
And I'm sure he also said hi to Terry Tyrell and Jade.
Yes, he sure did. Jim Duggan fought Bad News Brown to a double DQ in 3:47 when Bad News grabbed the chair, swung at Duggan with it. Duggan swung back with 2x4, dud. Dave said that Duggan's offense of punches and clotheslines was like an 80-year-old grandmother.
This would have been a much better match a few years earlier.
Yes. Red Rooster... or as Dave called him, Terry Requiem for a Heavyweight Taylor, pinned Bobby Heenan in 27 seconds after Heenan missed the block into the buckles. Brooklyn Brawler did a nice clothesline behind the head, which Taylor sold great after the match, but Taylor ran him off as well. Dud. Oh, man. Here's your main event. That was the match for the main event. Your main event, Hulk Hogan, the Hulkster, the Biggie, and a new Hogan record of 17 minutes and 51 seconds. That's what they said, the Biggie.
Taron Vostick. Also TV, Terry Bollea, Taron Vostick, the Biggie.
Yeah. And a new Hogan record of 17 minutes and 51 seconds. The mighty Hulkster captured the WWF title for the second time using the dreaded leg drop on Randy Savage. For those of you with tapes, watch Pat Patterson's hands as he tries to guard Liz as she came down the aisle. Thankfully, he was the perfect gentleman or something like that. Yes, Pat Patterson was the one that got a little touchy-feely there with Elizabeth. But, you know, we all know about Pat. you know, he could get away with something like that. But, yeah, hold on just a second. Let me get my spot here. All right. Thankfully, it was revealed. Savage had his elbow heavily taped as he had a staph infection, which I didn't know. There was never any chance of him actually missing this match, but it's a fairly serious injury. Hogan actually did a wrestling sequence in the drop toe hold early. They stalled. Hogan bled from above the eye, and when the blood from the first blade drop dried up, he did a second blade job in around 11 minutes. Liz got involved twice. Liz tried to help Savage, who yelled at her. Savage kept working over the eye. Hogan made his comeback. Liz got in the way of the post. He tried to post him. Savage posted him anyway. Liz tried to stop Randy from attacking Hogan. Finally, the ref and Randy had Liz disappear 14 minutes. That match just kept going. Hogan makes his comeback. Compared with the rest of the card, the heat was more like phenomenal. However, the finish was flat and worse than stupid. One could argue that it would have been better for Savage to keep it here, but even if they wanted to switch, there are a million ways they could have had Hogan win with Savage still not getting blown out. Anyways, it's all be said 1,000 times over about this finish. But after all the creative hype, this uncreative finish left a bad taste. 2¾ stars.
This is the least of their major matches together.
Yeah, and on the biggest scene.
Yeah.
After the main event, the crowd was looking around like, is that all there is?
Well, it wasn't a wrestling crowd.
Yeah, now Dave in a different section said that this was a one-match show, and it said every Rick on the Brook, which proves that great main events are what draw the record houses. Considering this was the biggest money event ever in wrestling, though, from what was delivered, this was way worse of a show than the last Saturday Night's main event, which was for free.
Hmm.
He's got a point there. I mean,
well, I'll put it this way. Yeah, I'm the little kid, but not long after the show, I could literally not remember a thing that happened other than the two title changes and the Piper Spit.
Yeah. That's about it.
Like, I remember whenever I first saw PWI, like, that had years later that, like, you know, had the historical stuff. I was like, wait, there were 14 matches on this card?
Yeah.
I only remember two.
Yeah. That's the way it goes sometimes.
That is a much, much, much better card than WrestleMania 4.
I know. That's worlds better. King Kong Bundy was sitting in the front row opposite the side of the camera and was cheering on the baby faces. That's funny. They made sure to have him seat on that side, it said.
Wait, opposite of the but opposite side of the camera sounds wrong, because that would mean he was on camera, but he wasn't.
The hard camera side.
So he was on the hard cam, what we call the hard camera side, the same side as the camera.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, Davey Boy Smith is trying hard to return here, but there are issues standing in his way right now.
Those issues are standing right next to him.
Yes. Now, Titan dumped Nick Bontwinkle, Pedro Morales, and Grizzly Smith as agents and told them that they were overstaffed and needed to make cutbacks. In all truth, though, they were hiring Dave Hedner and George Steele for those spots. Now, Nick Bontwinkle, Pedro Morales, and Grizzly Smith for Dave Hedner and George Animal Steele. That's an interesting trade. What does that say about the three that got let go?
Grizzly Smith was probably the most experienced road agent in pro wrestling at the time, though.
Yeah. Been doing it for years and years.
Well, there are a lot of things you were doing for years and years, but they weren't all good.
Yeah, and I didn't know Pedro Morales was a road agent. I never knew that. Bob Winkle, I knew. Pedro, I never knew that. I guess he was ready for some action.
I knew him. Well, it's in Bret Hart's book, remember?
Oh, that's right. That's right. I'm ready for action, brother. Any kind. And in our last story, RCA Columbia acquired the Continental Home Video rights to the upcoming No Holds Barred movie for $2.5 million. Now, there have been rumors during the week that the release of the movie would be pushed back. But Vince McMahon announced the week after that it was going to come out June the 2nd as planned, which it did. So, and I seem to remember that it was pretty big success on the video circuit.
Where would you even look? Does IMDb or anything have track home video gross?
I don't know, but I remember that it was a hard find in like rental stores.
That action movies and stuff like that tend to do much better on home, like B-level action movies tend to do fairly well on home video.
Yeah.
When they wouldn't necessarily find a big audience at theaters. Although it's not like it was a bomb in theaters.
Oh no.
It wasn't a giant smash hit, but it wasn't a bomb.
Yeah. All right. On that note, that's it for us this evening. And as Roman Reigns and his wife are on the stage, being interviewed by Byron Saxton in his interesting tuxedo in Maria Menounos.
You're a good 10 seconds ahead of me.
And Bix, what do you have to plug tonight?
Let's see. What do I have to plug tonight? Okay. Well, I'll start with this week's 605, a super podcast.
Yeah, let me say something about that real quick.
Oh, you did get to listen in time this week?
The Buzz Sawyer stuff on this show is awesome. I mean, just great, great, great stuff.
Thank you. Did you listen to the Michael Hayes thing yet?
Yes, I did, and I thought that was interesting as hell, too. But the Buzz Sawyer stuff I thought was the best.
Okay, so we have a special episode this week, and of course you can check that out at 605pod.com or look up 605 Super Podcast on iTunes or wherever else your fine podcasts are. I was going to say sold, but I didn't want to give the wrong impression. So it's two parts, basically, although we've got our usual shenanigans at the beginning. It's actually our usual housekeeping things goes 40 minutes, so we may have to – I don't know what we do with that. Two things. So with Buzz Sawyer, we ended up doing a thing on him because after we had talked about his school and our listener that had been to his school – contacted us. Sorry about that. My phone rang for a second.
Your phone rang, huh?
Yeah. I need to get a ringtone though. God. Where was I? Oh, so Buzz Sawyer. So we did a special segment on Buzz Sawyer. So we talked to Jim Cornette about the time that Dennis Condrey almost shot Buzz Sawyer with a gun, not shot on, shot, almost shot. We talked to Jason Rudy, who was a student at the Buzz Sawyer Wrestling School, and we talked to listener Will Sweedy, who had his own encounter with Buzz at the school. And then, in honor of Michael Hayes going into the Hall of Fame with the fabulous Freebirds, we've got something that Brian found in his collection of audio cassettes, which was Michael Hayes on a Dallas radio show in July 84, probably a week or two before he went to the WWF, and he is admittedly under the influence of alcohol during this whole thing. And it's quite interesting. It's maybe not quite as ridiculous as you'd expect, given Dallas, Michael Hayes, heel, Von Erich fans, etc. But
hey, this is like days after they got fired from Crockett for pissing on everybody.
Oh, I forgot about that. So they were back in so wait a second. So did they go from Crockett then get fired to WWF?
Well, they went back to Dallas.
And they went back to Dallas for 5 seconds.
And went back to WWF. And went to WWF, yeah.
Yeah. And it's
because the timeline for this show that somebody on Twitter had set up was it was like either the 12th, 13th, or 14th of July.
Right, because he said he had seen the Jacksons at Texas Stadium the night before. And those
and
were the three nights.
Michael Hayes, the Freebirds had worked Charlotte the week of July 4th. They worked the territory. That was when they did tapings and stuff.
Okay.
And then they were gone right after that for doing the pissing deal.
At David Crockett's. Or who was it? Was it David Crockett's wedding or Jimmy's?
I think it was Dave's.
Look at him.
He's Internet. Pissing, Tony.
Pissing. Right there. On my wife.
Piss on him. Piss on him. I've been watching a lot of David Crockett lately. I can't help it.
I couldn't either. Right there. He's looking.
Well, Bob Caldwell was there. Some of the redacted.
Oh, no. I don't think you even got out what you were trying.
I couldn't.
Anyway, 605vod.com. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Everything else, just follow from there.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be pushing on your Twitter feed all your articles and all the other goodness.
Assorted sundries, yes.
Yeah.
So, what do you got besides the including the Exile on Bad Street that I need to edit for you?
Yeah, and thank you for pushing back the curtain there. Exile on Bad Street is coming out sometime. It depends on when my editor will get it done. It was a good show. Really, really good show. Carl Stern's on with us, me and Bo James, for the first little over an hour because he had to go to work doing his police duty. And he hated he had to leave, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And then me and Bo rounded it out, telling him all things Continental from July 1986 through June 1987. And it's a really great show. Lots of great Bo James stories. The story about Adrian Street on there is phenomenal. About the first time when Adrian Street were babyface in Johnson City, Tennessee. What the fans were saying. And
One of the great stories. I haven't heard the show yet, but I've heard that story before. And yeah. It is a great one.
Yeah, and just other stuff talking about Kevin Sullivan and things like that. That's when Kevin Sullivan was in Continental raining down. Chris Colt. We talk about Chris Colt in the show. Chris Von Colt. Yeah, one of my all-time favorites. Talk about just everything that was going on. So check it out when it's out. Maybe it's out before this show drops. Who knows?
We never know. Yes. And, I'm sure the New Guinea headhunters are discussed.
Yes, that whole angle is discussed. Who were the headhunters?
The second year Continental, mid-86, mid-87.
Yeah, the full year. So, yeah, a lot of good stuff on there. All right, Between the Sheets, of course, is every Monday. And I already have a year picked out for next week, Vix. Or do you want to find out now?
1990?
It is in the 90s.
Did we talk about this and I forgot? Or no?
No, we haven't talked about this yet. That's why I was going to spring it up as a surprise to you on the air.
Okay. I can't think of this off the top of my head right now, especially because it's almost time for the Hall of Fame. So what is it?
1994. So we'll go back to 1994 on the next show.
And what are some of the major stories that week?
Well, let's talk about it. Let's do it. A quick tease for you. Two words. Tonya Harding. That's right. Tonya Harding in wrestling? Let's have two more words for you. Hulk Hogan. And some legal issues with WWF. On the good side for WWF in this week. And some other things going on. So, 1994 next week. Should be a fun show. We did miss Missy Hyatt's sexual harassment lawsuit by a week on that, though. But there's all kinds of other good stuff we talk about. Anyway, moving on to the end of the show. Bix, of course, I thank you for being my co-host as usual. You are the Rock, not Dwayne Johnson, Ole Anderson. But you are the Rock of this show. Without you, there isn't much of a Between the Sheets. So thank you for that. And Exile, in so many words, though. And I am your host, Chris Zellner, saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Ladies and gentlemen, live from Hollis, Queens, with the WrestleMania Wrap, it's Run DMC!
10. Believe that, boy. It denies WrestleMania 5.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for Run DMC.
A little bit of that went a long way with me, I'll tell you that. But you really ate it up, Jess.
I got into that, Gorilla. I like that.
I'm sure you did.